Right. It looks as if we have a number of the committee members present on my left, because as you know, we prefer to be able to see your faces when you speak, so we all sit there as a group of trade and industry on one side. But before I comment on seating arrangements and that kind of thing, let me first welcome everyone present, the committee, members of the committee who, after their grueling constituency period, are probably quite pleased to be back here on the benches, sitting quietly while engaging on steel. So we are very pleased to see you. I know that you did not have the opportunity to rest. And we, of course, don't have any opportunity here to put your feet up, really. We're on a very, very heavy schedule until we break in December. So we all have to just keep our heads down. I know you do. You're the most hardworking of the committees, one of them. I have a look at our schedule that we've done this year, and I can only congratulate you on your commitment. Thank you. Of course, there are one or two members not with us for very valid reasons, and they are the Honourable Njikalana, whom you know is a full member of PAT, well, not full, but he's deployed there from the South African Parliament to PAP, and the Honourable Impashlele, who's attending a defence committee meeting dealing with legislation. He attends a number of committee meetings, as you know, because he's a member of a number. And also the Honourable Smalley, I hope, who's also a member of Arts and Culture and has to deal with that as well. So for those who could be present here today, thank you very, very much for making this effort. I know some of you have had to get here early and so on. When I say early, from constituency work. On my right here, we have a number of people. As you address us, we will, of course, then greet you specifically, as it were. But at the moment, let me just say to those coming from perhaps perhaps I could say industry, whether agro-processing or anything in relation to that, canning and so on and so forth, your one common denominator is that steel affects you directly, if not indirectly then. So we appreciate you being here. We also appreciate you being here early, sufficiently early to ensure the technology and all the equipment is up and running and compatible with our system itself. Then I should also welcome, although they have just walked back in again, the parliamentary liaison officer from Trade and Industry, who's with us a great deal, Ms. Naidu. Thank you very much. And also our researcher and our committee assistant is one person who's on a kind of roster pool, so we get someone different all the time. On my right is the content specialist, Ms. Hurling, and on my left, the committee secretary with whom you deal frequently, Mr. Hermans. And I see here, sorry, just across from here, we have the DDG in this area, Mr. Nimrod Zulk from DTI. I'm sorry, I didn't see you earlier. So, and do you have any colleagues with you? Yes, if you could just give me your name. You're probably not here as frequently as Mr. Zulk.
Thanks, Chair. I'm Tandi Pele. I have been here a couple of times on the two issues. I'm the Chief Director for Metal Fabrication, Capital and Transport Equipment, Sector Desk in DTI.
Have to impress upon my mind your image. Thank you. And Dawood, who has already indicated the reason for his delay, a very legitimate one, the Honourable Khadebi. Thank you very much. And we're going to immediately go into it. The program itself, I am advised by the committee secretary that you may not all have the program in front of you, but suffice to say that the program is being brought along. I understand it is being printed. There was some technical hiccup, and you will be sharing and getting it. But the first presentation that we're engaging with on this very focused and targeted inquiry, investigation into the steel industry and related upstream and downstream, and that includes, of course, mining companies such as Kumba and the like, and also energy and transportation, etc. And I think you are fully aware of the committee's position on the cavalier manner in which this has currently been addressed by ArcelorMittal and to some extent by Kumba. So we have South African steel prices and the canning sector in 2010. Is that right? It's actually Professor, isn't it, Donald Ross from the University of Cape Town. You've been with us before, and you're very welcome again. So we've got your presentation here in front of us. I'm not sure if you'll also be displaying it. Oh, there we are. Because what we're looking at this particular point, from what I can see time-wise, because we're only starting now at 25 past or so, was the idea was, I think, to give each one of you about, or each presentation, I think it was 45 minutes or so, so not for the actual presentation, but for the whole engagement, etc. So I'm looking at this and rather hoping you may be able to proceed with this in about 20 minutes or so. So over to you, and we will note our questions and any need for clarification afterwards. Although please avoid all this, you know, these abbreviations, jargon, and this kind of thing, which you may be more familiar with than anyone sitting here. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Chair. Let me just, we can go to the first slide? Yeah, good, thanks. Let me just mention there was a bit of a timing wobble here in the sense that my office misplaced your brief for a couple of days. I was invited on Thursday. My office misplaced your brief for about 24 hours, and I did the slides before I saw it. So what I propose to do is add a few things now that directly address the questions on your brief, and I will then send through an updated version of the slides for the record tomorrow, if that's agreeable to the Chair. So, I've spent a few years... Sorry, Professor, it's Mr. Schwartman, who is a graduate student of mine, former graduate student of mine, who's now doing his PhD at the University of Toulouse in France, and he works on this topic with me. I've been doing some work on this industry, on the fruit canning industry, for about 3 years. Particularly interested in the conditions for that industry's international competitiveness, because, as many of you may know, that industry is overwhelmingly focused on exports. Right? About 90% of its sales volume occurs abroad. And as such, that industry lies in the cluster of sectors that are the current industrial policy in South Africa regards as the priorities. The competitiveness of our exports is a current policy priority. And so there's therefore a good deal of interest in the domestic conditions that are necessary to maintain that competitiveness. So let me say a little bit about directly answering your brief, and this is the material that I will add to the slides when I send you through some new slides tomorrow, or some amended slides. Let me say a few things in general about the canning industry, the investment climate around it, and the relationship between it and the steel price. Steel is the single most, well, after fruit itself, steel is the single most important input to fruit canning. The cost of tin plate at present accounts for about a little more than 30% of the total costs of production of a can of fruit. And that's the single biggest unit percentage. The steel that is used in that tin plate largely comes from South African sources. So there are some exceptions. Del Monte, which accounts for about 20% of the canned fruit market, of canned fruit production, Del Monte makes its own cans. Some of the tin plate it uses is imported. Some is not. The remainder of the industry, so the other 80% of the industry, about 60% of the steel input is AMSA produced, and about 40% is imported from Europe by CMB. So AMSA produced steel accounts for the lion's share of the steel input to the manufacture of cans that are used by the fruit canning industry. So we have here then the largest input, and we have AMSA producing the largest share of that largest input. So therefore the AMSA steel price is a very important determinant in the profitability of the fruit canning industry. Now, it's recently become a particularly important determinant because of the changes in AMSA's prices with which your committee is gathered here to deal. In April 2009, directly as a consequence of an increase in the price of steel, the price of tin plate to the canners was raised by just under 70%. And that generated in turn an increase in the price of cans to the industry of between 40 and 45%. During that period, the rand was also strengthening off a particularly low period. And so, given that this is so that amplified the increasing cost. So costs were rising in more valuable rand. Now, the slide that you see now in some ways summarizes it states the crucial part of the relationship from an economic point of view between the steel price and the canning industry. Because what really matters, right, I've given you some percentages. I've said, well, the cans are about 30% of the costs and AMSA steel is such and such a percentage of that input and so on. But all those percentages don't tell you very much. The crucial fact you need is what's the effect of a percent rise in the price of steel on the price that the canners must charge for a can of fruit that they export. Because that in turn determines, that's what's telling you how the steel price affects the competitiveness of the industry. Right? If there was some way, for example, in which the industry could swallow the steel price increases and maintain the same can prices for its foreign customers, you would just conclude that, well, the industry was formerly is perhaps taking a hit in profits, perhaps that'll affect the attractiveness of investments in the industry, but perhaps the industry can remain competitive. Economists refer to this as elasticity. So what's the responsiveness of one price, in this case the price that the industry must charge for cans of fruit in Europe and elsewhere in its other markets, what's the responsiveness of that price to changes in the steel price? So that, you see that there in the second bullet on the slide that is up now. So a 45 to 55% increase in the price of cans, as we had in April 2009, raises canned fruit production costs by about 15%. And then in turn, if the fruit canners must pass on a 15% increase in their output price to European importers, right, that is Europeans who are importing South African cans of fruit, that would predict a 22.5% decrease in export volumes because of the effect of the price in Europe. This is a very price-sensitive industry. Right? Most consumers of canned fruit are not brand loyal. Right? They don't prefer South African fruit to fruit from other places. So they're very price-responsive. And when there's an increase in the price of South African canned fruit, that results in a disproportionate drop in our sales volume. There is an upper-end market internationally, a very small upper-end market, but a lucrative one with much higher markups, in which South African canned fruit has higher quality and earns a bit of a premium. But that small lucrative market for us has to be supported from the point of view of economies of scale by our being able to sustainably produce quite a lot of canned fruit in the mass market. Right? If we didn't have the mass market, we wouldn't be able to maintain the economies of scale to be competitive in the premium market where we have an advantage. So it's very important that we at least, that we maintain that large mass market, and as you can see from the third bullet on the current slide, that is threatened directly when there's an increase in the steel price. Now, one of the reasons that experts are very worried when we see when we see competitiveness of this industry threatened is that it lives in a very fragile investment climate. There has been underinvestment in this industry by the key parties that need to invest in it, so capital investors, but also farmers planting new fruit trees and bringing new land under cultivation for fruit for canning. There's been underinvestment in the industry for some time. And that underinvestment, right, reflects concern about the viability of the industry as a result of several considerations. Historically, the price of steel was not a major source of worry. Historically, the biggest discouragement to investment in the industry have been the trade barriers that South African canned fruit faces in our export markets, particularly subsidies and other kinds of programs that that European governments have been providing to their farmers and agro-processors. And there are some other difficulties that the industry has had, and those have discouraged investment. Naturally, however, if you've already got a discouraged investment climate, and it's particularly dangerous if there is a squeeze on profits or a squeeze on sales volumes, because that's likely to be regarded by the potential investors as a fulfillment of their fears, and that will amplify whatever nervousness they had to begin with. It's fairly easy to demonstrate that the fruit canning industry would be competitive in the absence, in a world of freer trade, in a situation where we had better market access. And long term, it's the policy of the government to try to improve that market access. In the meantime, one worries that we could lose the industry if the current investment nervousness turns into an investment strike. If investors will not supply capital to the industry, or if the farmers turn their attention elsewhere, produce other crops instead, the consequence could be that we would see a very rapid contraction in our capacity to produce canned fruit for export. You could see a kind of consolidation, the industry shrinking to be mainly a domestic supplier. And it's directly contrary to our current industrial policy to allow one of our main, a leading exporter, to abandon export markets. That's the big worry here. Right? The big worry here is losing one of our successful, well-connected export industries. What difference would that make to people on the ground? Well, the industry directly employs about 11,000 people, mostly in the Western Cape, and it indirectly supports another 18,000 or so. So as industries go in terms of its effect on labor and welfare, this is not one of the big ones. But 30,000 people is significant welfare, as especially those of you who have constituencies in the Western Cape or in the rural Western Cape are acutely aware. We'll go to the next slide, please. Now, this slide, the title of this slide, Import Parity Pricing, refers to a concept that is not officially the basis of the way in which the steel industry works anymore. So, the idea of import parity pricing is you ask yourself what it would cost for industry in South Africa to buy your input if they sourced it from abroad. And then you set your price to match that price. Now, that is not literally what AMSA does. So, if that was literally what it did, it would, for example, take into account the cost of shipping steel from a port to the users of the steel, and it would factor that into its price. That would be literal import parity pricing. It doesn't literally do that. However, it effectively does much the same thing, because AMSA's domestic prices are based to the can makers are based on a basket of international prices. It uses a formula that takes prices of steel in a number of other countries. You'll see which countries in some of the countries in a slide coming up. Looks at the price in the basket of countries, and it roughly averages that price with some weighting for the size of those markets, and produces it and outputs a domestic price. Now, there's different reasons why import parity pricing makes sense in some markets. If you're a producer in a very important market, and the price in your market affects the world price, then you have to be careful, right? You could wind up undermining your own profits as a result of pricing competitively in your home market. But that doesn't really apply here. South Africa's steel market is very small. It has no influence on the global price. Some of the other input prices, input costs to steelmaking are unusually low here. So steel prices in South Africa ought to be, by world standards, quite competitive. And that should be a source of comparative advantage for our exporters. That is one of the, they should benefit in their competition on export markets from the fact that they can get, that it's possible to make steel here relatively inexpensive. So long as we have something approximating import prior parity pricing, we are failing to exploit that possibility. Next slide, please. Now, something got cut off a little bit here. This shows the domestic prices of tin plate in rands per ton up to, this is the part of the slide that somehow got cut off. Oh, there we go. Up to September 2009. So this reflects the price increase in April 2009, just before there was a substantial price decrease in October 2009. So I'm talking now about a previous period before the present period, and then we're going to use that to see what we can say about what's happening in the present period. Now, I realize the legend on the slide is a little bit too small for you to see. But it's quite simple, this graph. The blue line that you see sort of crawling along the bottom at first and then shooting straight up and then moving straight along all by itself, away from the other lines, right? Just moving straight across the graph. That is AMSA's price. That's the tin plate price to the can makers, domestic can makers in South Africa, from July 2008 through September 2009. And the dotted line, the point at which it breaks, is September 2009, before AMSA reduced its prices. Now you can see that AMSA's prices are counter-trending all the other graphs are international prices, are prices of tin plate in other countries. Now you can see that AMSA starts off with a low price relative to international prices, and then that price shoots up. So AMSA starts to catch up to international prices, but it does so just as the international prices are falling. And so by about July of 2009, well, from April really of 2009, right, after the big price increase by AMSA, AMSA's prices are significantly above international prices. Now we do, when we first prepared this slide in September 2009, AMSA had announced that an adjustment was planned based on that formula I told you about a few minutes ago. And we were wondering, right, how big that reduction would be. And the dotted lines that you see following that break line, those represented our projections back then as to possible directions of AMSA's price depending on how it interpreted its own formula. Okay? So let's see what happened. Okay, we're not going to see what happened quite yet. I want to tell you a little bit more about the starting point. So these compare AMSA's prices in September 2009 with prices in other markets. So these are just some supporting data for the graph that I just showed you. It showed that at that time, these data suggest that at that time, depending on what AMSA did, it could have been profitable for South African can makers to source their tin plate from other countries instead of buying domestic tin plate. So you would have expected there should have been pressure on AMSA to significantly reduce its prices, lest it's because its customers not only had incentive to, but a capacity to move away from it. Next slide, please. All right, so in October 2009, AMSA reduced its prices. We think by about, and we have to do some inferences here as to what the exact price decrease was, but and some averaging and some careful calculating, but we think the accurate figure is about 28%. And this shows you AMSA's October 2009 price. So after the price decrease, that's the red bar, against, and this is the price to the can makers, against the prices in some of the countries that enter into the basket. Those are the light blue bars. And then the dark blue bar is the basket. So we apply AMSA's formula to those other prices, and we produce the bar that is supposed to be AMSA's comparator. Remember, the basic idea of their pricing policy is that that should be the basis for the South African domestic price. But now look, in October, the red bar is still significantly higher than that dark blue bar. So we think that the October 2009 price reduction did not, in fact, fully compensate for the price hike of April 2009 and the subsequent fall in international prices. Next slide, please. This graph shows AMSA's price, which is the line with the red dots on it, the line that is above all the other lines most of the way across. Those are AMSA's prices, again, against the prices of the countries that I showed you on the previous slide. You can see that for a while, for a period there, in mid-2009, prior to the October 2009 price reduction, for a little period, AMSA's prices are way above the basket prices. And then they come down, but they never come all the way down to the basket. Now you can see that the dotted line here represents March 2009. We've not been able to find data we consider reliable since that time. That's why we've drawn our break point there. That is data on AMSA's prices to the can makers. You'll see that during that period since March 2009, international prices have risen a bit. So the natural question to, and at that point, AMSA's prices are still a little bit higher than the basket price. Now what we want to know is, what might have happened, what do we think happened to AMSA's prices compared to those international prices since March 2009? Next slide, please. So this slide represents our estimate as of August 2010. Now, this estimate is based on inference. We don't know what AMSA's price is to the can makers, but we do have data on the price of cans. It is possible, right, that the can makers are increasing their profit margins. So suppose AMSA reduced its prices to correspond to the basket price, but the can makers decided that they would increase their profits by not following the AMSA price reduction with a price reduction of their own. That could be what is going on. We doubt it. We doubt it because we think that AMSA has some reasons to, has sound strategic reasons, reasons that are sound from its own point of view, as to why it would be less responsive to the price sensitivity of end users like fruit canners than the can makers. The can makers depend more, much more directly than AMSA does on the health of the of their immediate customers, of the fruit canners. And historically, they have therefore generally been more sensitive to the situation of those industries. So, our best guess based on history, what would be most consistent with historical record, is that the 5% increase in the price of cans to the fruit canners that we've seen over the past few months is a translation of an expression of an increase in AMSA's price. But I'm sure you'll be hearing later from representatives of the steel industry who may supply facts I don't have at this point, and they may be able to answer that question. We have the next slide, please. We think, however, our general conclusions, and of course to fully support these, I couldn't fully support these conclusions on the basis of the little bit of information I've shown you just now, but we've prepared a number of full reports over the last couple of years that marshal a range of arguments for a general view that the very considerable pricing power that AMSA has in this market is generally deleterious to the welfare of the export sectors that use steel as a significant input. Now, as you know, and as others will tell you, including the representatives of the steel industry, that's not the only consideration that good public policy would take into account. There are reasons why South Africa wants to have a healthy steel industry, and there are reasons why South Africa would want to be able to assure investors in that steel industry of sustainable, healthy profits. There's a history to AMSA's pricing powers, and that history is based in deliberate public policy choices, some of which go way back to the setting up of ISCOR and the way in which ISCOR was privatized. So, I'm not necessarily claiming that every aspect of AMSA's pricing power is damaging to the South African economy. This is making a limited claim, but it's an important claim, that in my opinion, the pricing power that AMSA presently has puts some export sectors at risk. And again, just to reiterate, the key reasons for that are that the fruit canning industry is overwhelmingly an export industry. It is an industry selling product in a very price-sensitive market, and it is an industry that is operating in a fragile investment climate with nervous investors. and therefore it's a highly at-risk industry because it could suddenly fall off a cliff. Now, the second remark here refers to overpricing. Let me be clear that overpricing isn't an idea that even makes sense, except relative to some benchmark. The benchmark in this case that we're using is AMSA's own formula. Now, we could have a whole other argument about whether that formula is well chosen, whether that formula represents good pricing policy from one point of view or another. But let's bracket that discussion. Suppose we thought that AMSA's formula was a good formula from some public policy point of view. Well, then relative to that, our estimate, given the limited data that we've been able to source, is that AMSA's prices, at least to the can makers, are about 8% higher than that. To fully test that figure, what we would need to do is a proper pricing survey. There are techniques economists use to get quite reliable and precise estimates of prices. But for that one needs some time and resources, more than I could muster since being asked to address your committee 4 days ago. So please bear in mind that this estimate is just an estimate, and it's not an estimate based on very good data. It's based on the best information that we were able to get in a short period of time. And I've given you some of the history and some of the basis underlying that estimate over the last few minutes. So with that, I will stop. Thank you for your attention, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Professor Ross. That concise and illuminating exploratory information on the steel price currently and its impact historically and currently. So further to the committee, I would appreciate if members of the committee, if you would not preface your questions or clarification with huge preambles, one. And once there have been your question or clarification has been responded to, try to refrain from engaging in dialogue with the person who is responding. And thirdly, it is generally a convention in Parliament for committee members to wait to be recognized before blurting out. So all of that would be appreciated. And on my side, I will obviously try to observe the conventions as required by chairs here. So I don't want to start immediately on huge time restrictions, but just to remind us that we shouldn't go on too long and try to restrict it as far as possible to a couple of minutes or so. Hands up then, please. So we had, I see they have already been recognized by the committee secretary, so I can just indicate.
I want to make a proposal, Chair.
Yes, certainly.
That may be accepted. How about us having another presentation of the CAN, and thereafter we can actually, so that we can actually, yes, have more information on CAN industry, then we can ask questions. That's a proposal.
It's quite a constructive input. How do the rest of the committee feel on that note? You're able to, you know, note all of the points you wanted? Yes, Honourable September? I think it's a very constructive point. So, obviously, Professor Ross, you'll just sit tight, as it were, and then we'll call upon the South African fruit and vegetable canning industry as a group It's always very healthy to see that quite a broad group comes along, and it will be useful to see exactly who will be leading. I know that last time you had an overview and then different inputs and focuses from the different members of the panel. So if you can indicate to us, don't want to make mistakes on your names, if you can indicate the person who will be leading that particular discussion and engagement.
Thank you, Chair. Just as an indication in terms of leading the presentation, I will be taking you through the entire presentation. However, in attendance, we have Mr. Nassus Martellus from Langeberg and Ashton Foods, and we also have Mr. Job Mpele from Rhodes Food Group. I'm Jill Atwood-Palm. I'm from the SA Fruit and Vegetable Canners Association. And Job and Nassos is from two of the manufacturing companies and are certainly available for any questions or further clarity.
Right. So just confirming that Mr. Gerhard Kotze is not with you today.
So I can perhaps just render an apology from Mr. Vernon Duplessis. He's from Langeberg and Ashton Foods. He's also the chairperson of the Canners Association. Mr. Gerrit Kotzer also tendered an apology, and hence the reason why Mr. Job Mpele has in fact kindly availed himself in Mr. Kotzer's place. I will perhaps even indicate at this stage, and I think it's fairly hot off the press, just last night we received the announcement from the Competitions Commission that the acquisition between Rhodes and Del Monte has in fact been approved. And the reason for Mr. Kotz's apology this morning was in fact that first thing this morning they in fact commencing with their restructuring program and making the formal announcements. Thank you.
Thank you very much for briefing us on the latest information as well. And then over to you and your team, Ms. Atwood-Palm. Yes. Is that correct?
That's
and
correct.
Welcome then to Mr. Job Mpele, as well as Mr. Nassos Martellus. And I think that's it, is it, at the moment?
That's correct.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have all members got the presentation, the hard copy? Thank you.
And the first slide that you see, I think, just sums up all the changes in terms of our industry delegation today, which I've just taken you through a few minutes earlier. In terms of content, the various areas that we'll be covering in the presentation is firstly the general profile of the fruit and vegetable canning industry, the current status in the industry, and the next section will deal with the actual steel pricing in South Africa, which we hope will cover all the various points as raised in the brief that came from the committee. We'll also give you an indication with regard to the impact on the canning industry. We'll also put forward certain or possible solutions or alternatives that we could review, as well as closing remarks. If I could just mention at this point, a number of the points in our presentation has also been raised by Professor Don Ross. So I'm not going to dwell on them in any amount of detail unless there are specific questions at the end of the presentation should you require any further clarity. In terms of the general profile of the industry, firstly it is, I'm Joel from the Canners Association. The association is in fact a national body, covering both fruit and vegetables in the agro-processing sector. Most of our factories, most of our units are in fact rurally based in very small towns scattered across South Africa. Traditionally, or I should say in terms of the natural attributes of the fruit, deciduous fruit is predominantly in the Western Cape. Deciduous fruit, being your peaches, pears and apricots, has its concentration in the Western Cape. Pineapples, we have a facility in the Eastern Cape, as well as the Rhodes Food Group also has a pineapple facility in Swaziland. Vegetables are pretty much geographically spread throughout South Africa with a degree of concentration up north.
Our packaging mediums vary over plastic, cans, and glass, of which I note at this point that cans is still the biggest form of packaging medium that we utilize in the industry. Again, in terms of the agro-processing sector, we in fact, in terms of the value add of our products, it is to the extent of about 200% of value that we add to the actual raw materials that we process. We have the potential to be 99% of local or South African origin. However, the change over the last couple of years has been around the importation of pineapples, as well as the importation of cans, has changed that profile from potentially being 99% South African origin. In terms of pineapples, the pineapple industry in the Eastern Cape has elected not to resume canning operations, and that's largely attributed to the actual cost of the can. Secondly, in terms of the cost of the can, a degree of tin plates and or cans, in fact, over the past couple of years have been imported, hence changing the potential of the industry to be a 99% South African origin product. In general, we support over 140 dependents in rural areas across South Africa. In terms of farming or the agricultural side of it, we process more than 400 tons of fruit and over 200 tons of vegetables, and this is produced on an annual basis. This is sourced from about 1,500 farms, employing close to 20,000 farm workers. In terms of manufacturing in the Western Cape, which is traditionally your fruit stronghold, there are four fruit canning factories. Just to point out, those four fruit canning factories are now in fact only owned by two companies. Two of the factories are owned by Langeberg and Ashton Foods, and that was as a result of the merger which took place in 2005 between Langeberg and Ashton Foods in that area. So that was as a result of one merger that took place in 2005. As I mentioned earlier on, there was a recent acquisition, as recent as last night, that was approved by the Competitions Commission, between the Rhodes Food Group and the Del Monte Fruit South African Division. There's also one jam unit situated in Paarl. There are three fruit concentrate factories also located in the Western Cape. There's one pineapple processor in the Eastern Cape and over 10 vegetable or related units spread pretty much all over South Africa. It is a very labor-intensive environment, and more than 14,000 factory workers are linked to these various units that we sketched above. In terms of our socio-economic profile, being a very labor-intensive environment, our factories are in fact the main employers in most of the rural areas across South Africa. And as I mentioned previously, these are very small towns where job opportunities generally are very limited. Being a labor-intensive environment, it is in fact an environment where jobs are being created and where employment opportunities are being created. Also, being a factory environment, it also requires a much higher level of skill within these factories. Most of our factories, or all our factories, are direct contributors to beneficiated agriculture. We provide value-added products and food security within the agro-processing sector. They're also significant and direct contributors to rural development, community upliftment, as well as transformation objectives. The actual size of the industry in terms of both fruit and vegetables amounts to just over 5 billion rand, of which fruit has an export value of about 2 billion. So in terms of fruit on its own, about 85% of the South African fruit products are exported. South Africa accounts for about 8% of the total world export fruit market. So just to give you an indication, on the fruit side of things, strongly export driven, on the vegetable side of things, about 95% is for domestic consumption. Our competitive advantage, we a well-established and long-standing industry with a very reliable supply of both fruit and vegetables, strong manufacturing capabilities, adopting world-class standards, hence putting us or giving us the opportunity in terms of claiming our rightful place as experienced exporters in the global markets. We deliver premium quality products of a highly nutritional benefit, and this is fully backed by scientific research. We also have entered into a partnership with stakeholders across the value chain. To give you an indication in terms of the industry's long-term outlook, we have a public-private partnership that we've entered into with stakeholders across the value chain. And that's in terms of government, business, labor, and community participating within this initiative. The initiative itself is to create a sustainable platform for the long-term growth and competitiveness of the industry, hinging on four main pillars, namely the improvement of market access, competitiveness, marketing, and transformation. The reason why I cover this is also to give the indication that the industry has a very long-term view. The industry has also been included as one of the priority sectors on government's industrial policy action plan. And this flowed from a very well-founded research basis, which was completed independently by UCT. The key research findings was that the industry does have growth potential, is export-driven, and is competitive, and hence its inclusion on both IPAC 1 and on IPAC 2, which was released in February 2010. Turning to the current status in the fruit and vegetable canning industry, I think we've sketched out that through the benefits of the Industrial Policy Action Plan and the industry being a worthy recipient for industrial policy, as well as the partnership we have in terms of the fruit canning initiative, we believe that there are mechanisms in place to create a sustainable platform for ultimately the long-term growth of the industry. However, there are a number of short-term challenges facing the industry. The global recession, secondly the exchange rate, which has certainly placed the industry in a very disadvantageous position in terms of its export returns, market access conditions, both into the established markets as well as the emerging markets, and then we turn to the actual impact in terms of input costs. And in this regard, we'd like to move to the actual steel pricing in South Africa. The actual structure of both the steel and the can-making industry. Firstly, the structure of the steel and can-making industry has certainly had a very negative impact on downstream users. The tin plate supplier, being ArcelorMittal South Africa, is a monopolistic player. And in turn, the actual can-making industry, there are only two main players, namely Nampak and Carno Metalbox, of which one is a super dominant player with more than 85% market share. With a structure like that, there is little to no room for negotiation. Looking at the steel pricing structure in South Africa, again, I'm not going to dwell in detail with regard to the actual pricing structure because I think in the previous presentation this was covered in a fair amount of detail. The previous pricing model of AMSA is described as an import parity pricing formula. The current model is in fact a benchmarking pricing formula against the basket of eight countries, five of which are developed countries, three of which are developing countries, and this then averages out a US dollar-based price across this basket of eight countries, and also translated against the dollar-rand exchange rate. The impact of this is the charging of global prices for South African-based products, and certainly a company enjoying lower local production costs than most countries. The biggest knock on industry was certainly the price increase passed on by ArcelorMittal in April 2009 to the level of 68%. Further, in terms of technological constraints, AMSA's lack of technology has also had an impact on the competitiveness of the canning industry. Firstly, AMSA is only producing single reduced tin plates. And that's, in terms of technical terms, rolling the tin plate to a thickness of 0.21 millimeters. The world trend is that our competitors have all moved to DR, which is double reduced tin plate, rolling to a thickness of about 0.16 millimeters. This has certainly given our competitors the advantage of lower costs of cans. There is no technology within AMSA at present to be able to produce double reduced tin plate for the South African market. And this has certainly led to impeding on the competitiveness of the South African canning industry. We have very firm indications that DR plated cans can in fact be imported. And this is approximately 10% cheaper on a landed cost basis. In fact, on an ex-works basis, it is about 25% cheaper than the cans we are obtaining within South Africa. To give you an indication with regard to ArcelorMittal's tin plate increases and how this translated onto the price of cans, again this was covered in a fair amount of detail in the previous presentation by Professor Ross. The biggest knock in terms of tin plate came about in April 2009, the increase of 68%, translating into a can price impact of between 45 to 55%. In October 2009, AMSA reviewed their pricing structure and decreased the price of tin plate by approximately 30%. And this translated into the price of cans decreasing between 15 to 17%. However, on a season-to-season basis, despite this decrease, it still had an overall impact of 25 to 30% increase on the actual price of cans for the 2009 production season, overall increasing our cost of product by about 15%. In April 2010, it is very difficult for us to assess at this point what formula was utilized by AMSA for any price adjustment in terms of tin plate. We tried unsuccessfully to obtain this information, but up to Friday we were unable to do so. However, in terms of the actual can price impact, cans increased between 3 to 5%. And in October 2010, which it was supposed to be adjusted from the 1st of October this month, that information has not yet been released as to what the impact in terms of can price increases or tin plate. What the increase may or decrease may in fact be. In terms of cans, where AMSA works on the benchmarking pricing formula across the basket of countries, the can makers in fact increase their prices on a cost plus basis. So that increase is then passed on directly to the actual fruit canning or vegetable canning companies. Historically, the cans was in fact 25% of our input costs. As a result of the increases since April 2009, it is now currently 30% of our input costs. In fact, cans cost more than the fruit and the vegetables that we're putting into the cans. It is the single biggest cost of production that we have in our industry. The next graph is really just showing the trend of what we call can inflation, in inverted commas, in relation to the actual rate of exchange. And what we did was we plotted out the rate of exchange from the period of 1999 through to 2010 against what we say is can inflation, or how the cans have increased in relation to the rate of exchange. Now you'll see a substantial peak in 2009, and that has created a gap of nearly 50% between the rate of exchange and the level of, in which the actual cans increased. Despite the decrease, the gap is still substantial between the level or the rate of exchange and the actual price of cans. There's still a margin between the, or gap between the two of approximately 40%. The actual impact on the competitiveness of the canning industry is in fact a double whammy in terms of both the domestic market and the export market. The impact of increases on the price of cans, of the finished product, was passed on to the consumer on the South African market, the result being that there has been a decline in consumer demand. This has also led to a surge of imports onto the local market. South African industry certainly cannot compete, as there are a number of imports coming into our country where these countries in fact enjoy duty-free access into South Africa, for example the EU trading bloc. In terms of our product being exported to the EU, it is still subject to a duty. EU product coming into South Africa in fact comes in duty-free. In terms of the export market impact, there was certainly no room to pass on increases within the export market. I think Professor Ross said in his presentation the market is extremely price sensitive, and the South African industry is largely a price follower within the global markets. The result being the non-competitiveness of the South African industry within the global markets. Margins, as we stand today, have been completely eradicated. And this has drastically reduced our export returns and has led to a reduced manufacturing base. Just some signals in the industry. I mentioned earlier on our local pineapple industry, despite being in a position to resume canning operations, have taken the decision not to resume canning operations. And this is largely as a result of the cost of the can. A major international company has also disinvested in South Africa, the example being Del Monte Fruit South Africa, as was recently acquired by the Rhodes Food Group. The indications from their side were extremely strong that if in fact the acquisition between Rhodes and Del Monte, if that did not take place, their decision would have been to disinvest in South Africa anyway. South African canners are certainly exploring all options to remedy uncompetitive cost structures, and this is going as far as mergers, acquisitions, some of the examples I've mentioned earlier on. There's also a great potential in terms of reduced fruit intake, and also then the correlation or the knock-on in terms of the impact on labour. We have a massive infrastructure within the industry, a massive investment of industry, which is now under threat. And this is in terms of land, infrastructure, etc. Possible solutions and alternatives. We believe that there should be a fair and transparent competitive steel and can pricing structure in South Africa. With regard to improvements in technology, there should be improvements in respect of tin plates. The example quoted is double reduced tin plates or plating, and also further canning innovation. Increased competition in respect of steel and can making in terms of the number of players in the market. Also going as far as investigating the feasibility of our own can making facility within our industry, and possible support for the importation of either tin plates and or cans. Closing remarks. Without any intervention, and I think we've sketched it out, there are a number of signals in the industry which may have a very negative impact or long-term impact for our industry in terms of factory closures, deindustrialization, potential job losses, greater impact in terms of the rural communities and a supply chain knock-on. We've mentioned certain solutions or alternatives which could be reviewed, investigated, in order to make the situation a lot more competitive for our industry. In terms of the industry's long-term growth, I think it has been shown in terms of very well-founded research that the industry is competitive, has a long-term future, and hence the reason with certain interventions would certainly could potentially put us on that platform for our long-term growth and future within the industry. In closing, the current challenges in the industry could seriously impact the long-term future of our business. The support and interventions that we've noted further, which we've noted previously, should be explored to reduce the adverse cost structure, particularly in results of steel and cans. That, in closing, is our presentation, and we certainly welcome any questions, and thank you for the opportunity for having us here today.
Yes, thank you very much to Ms. Atwood-Palm. What I think is your colleagues will probably join you in responses later on to questions, but in consideration especially as one of your colleagues needs to fly to Paris, I understand. We're going to move on to the South African Institute of Steel Construction, and that would be Dr. Henny de Klerk, and is it Mr. Cobus de Beer? Is that right? And who will actually be making the presentation? I don't know, because we do it. So we can make it on.
Chair. Yes, we are, Chair. We're really covering a different subject, different class of grade of steel.
In that case, then, we'll deal with the two presentations, and that is the one by Professor John Ross, as well as the South African fruit and vegetable canning industry. And with our time right now, just before 11:30, we should certainly be able to release yourself then. So, members, I know we began to already note the Honourable Khadebe, the Honourable Kotsi, and the Honourable Albert, the Honourable September, the Honourable Harris, right, the Honourable Kumalo, yes, we won't be taking any tail enders. The Honourable Oriani Ambusini. So that then takes account of all of you. Of course, you may have, as it were, a little follow-up in case your question was not sufficiently or adequately responded to. And I want to make it clear, from time to time we have had written responses should we require a fuller, more detailed response. But we're going to now make it short, the questions and clarification, Honourable Khadebe.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. I think what the first thing which I would like to say is to appreciate the inputs which were made today. I think that they gave a direct impact on the issue of steel, of ArcelorMittal in particular, on the issue of downstream industry. But part of the public hearing is to get suggestions on the way forward, because we have to make those decisions as Parliament so that we help the community at large. So what we'll appreciate is the suggestions coming from the people who are affected on the ground, how it impacts upon them. That's why I agree with Professor Ross when he said that it is the issue of public policy choice. We are making that choice. We expect them to help us in taking the right decision. I can make the first example. Which countries in the world allow the issue of basket type of pricing or the issue of import parity? Because really it is unique. As Professor Ross was correct, that We take our comparative advantage, we destroy it. Ne? So what must we do? Which countries in the world are using that type of pricing? Because they are doing research every day. So what countries are using that? Ne? Number two, this issue of the second presentation, I like the alternatives which are put there. Ne? The first one is the issue of fair and competitive steel and tire pricing structure. Really, I think that for the past, since ArcelorMittal became a private company, it has not been achieved. How do you suggest we should achieve that? Must we make law in Parliament here to force the private sector that how much can they add up on their input costs? What is it you suggest we must do? And then number two, number three will be the issue. I also appreciate the issue of increasing competition in the steel, in respect of the steel industry. I think that in the previous weeks, the ITC has made calls or requests for proposals about the formation of small mills, steel mills across the country. To go forward, are you amenable to such a suggestion? Is it going to make any dent on the input prices of the canning industry? I'll take those three, and then I'll come back later if possible.
These are noted. I'm sure you appreciate that.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, on the first presentation on the page that talks about price basket for October 2009, I would want the professor to explain. He says even after reduction, the prices of ArcelorMittal South Africa was still very high, and there is a graph to that. I would want to know how then did they come, to that graph, the orange part. How did they come to that? If they talk about reduction, and in your calculation, you also indicate that they are still very high. How did they come to that, and how did you yourself, what determination did you use to come to that orange part? The second question perhaps is, why is it difficult to access information from AMSA in order actually to be accurate? Because why should South Africans keep on guessing or getting information? I presume this is public information. We should be accurate as South Africans. We can't thumbs up when we actually give information to especially about issues like this. And perhaps it should be a matter for Parliament as well, Honourable Beke, that we can't be misled or keep on saying we think when there should be information that should be public knowledge. The second one, perhaps this one is to the department. Can the department explain to us why the EU is enjoying duty-free to South Africa and we are not enjoying the same, because that is actually putting us on the back foot as South Africans. I think that should be answered by the... in terms of non-resumption of canning operations, mainly in the Eastern Cape, how many jobs have we lost due to that? And perhaps as recently as the portfolio committee, we visited the Eastern Cape and we saw how the lemons as well can, that production mainly used for being imported, somewhere in the Port Elizabeth or Utenek area, and how much of that is actually inputting on that. But it's fruit, but it's not canned, yeah. It's bottled? Yeah, I think it's bottled. Yeah, okay. Maybe you can help us. We want to know, you say you are investigating feasibility of own can making. If you can share that with us a bit. Our concern is that AMSA is our steel in South Africa, and we want that to be utilized as much as possible, but we do not want to lose jobs because of their prices, and perhaps if those suggestions can be something that we can be worked out and we'll understand what are they. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much, Honorable Elbert.
Thank you, Chair. Professor Ross, in establishing the overpricing percentage, I know you're working with data that's not complete. You say that there are certain methods that you can use, certain survey methods that economists use, but you need resources in that respect. Can you just clarify what those resources would be and how we would be able to assist in regard to that so that we can actually have valid information with which we can confront AMSA with? Thank you.
And Honourable September.
Chair, thank you very much, and also thank you for the presentations that we have received. I want to ask if in listening to the two presentations, I want to establish, is the price of steel one problem that is the biggest problem, or if you link the steel price to all the other different aspects, whether it's the regulatory cost or whether it is the strength of the rand at the moment, all sorts of other alternative costs. In your presentation, I couldn't establish whether you say it is because of the steel price, but we can live with all the other things, or is it a combination of all of them together that is the problem? It's important for us to establish that, because if we tackle the steel price only, will you still hold the same arguments? So that's the first one that I wanted to know. I also wanted to establish, and I think you indicated a little bit about the employment, the negative employment issue, but I don't think in your presentation you alluded to that. If you could give us, you know, maybe sort of a 10-year synopsis, maybe not today, but a 10-year synopsis of the job creation or the negative effects on job creation due to the steel prices. I also wanted to know, Chair, are there any alternatives to cans? Let me just leave it like that. Because there are all sorts of things. Chair, and then my last one would be, I think I have spoken, added in my first question, if we can add the exchange rate issue also in there. The last one that I want to ask is, do you think that our current trade policy that we have does create a climate where all of you can make adjustments, and changes that you can make in terms of, market forces, both here and abroad. Chair, let me leave it there. And I wanted to suggest, Chair, that I think it maybe will help if we have an oversight visit to these industries to see for ourselves, apart from the public hearing. I'm saying that, I'm suggesting, Chair, that maybe it will be a good idea if we actually have an oversight visit. I know our program is very tight, but I think it would help quite a bit if we actually can for ourselves see that. And then I think at the same time we should as a committee be, I really want to emphasize this thing that we should be having some public hearings on the EU agreement. I've never been a supporter of the components of how the agreement has been put together, and we should maybe do that. Chair, thanks.
Thank you very much. Honourable Harris.
Thanks, Chair. I hope it's admissible, but Professor Ross, in the presentation we were handed out, there's a graph that shows a slightly longer view. It's called Domestic Prices of Tinplate and Rand, and goes right from January 08. Now, you can see, if you look at that graph, it's probably the fifth or the sixth page, that for the year from about March 08 to March 09, by the looks of things, if we accept the basket of goods pricing strategy, the alkyl methyl price was quite substantially below that price. And I guess looking at this graph, it makes sense that at some point that had to adjust, because therefore they were making, you know, virtual losses on their strategy. And then clearly the problem is that basket of good prices then declined from the beginning of 09, and the answer price didn't decline in turn. But looking at the big picture, if that price then did come down in October, the area below the graph for the year 08 probably outweighs the area above the graph after that period. So to me, on balance, if AMSA was sitting here, they may say that relative to their basket of goods strategy, they're out of pocket, and in fact they were at a lower price than they should have been for the initial period. If you could comment on that. Both presentations spoke about international providers landing inputs here at a lower cost. Why then didn't the industry just simply buy those inputs, specifically with regards to the canning industry and that HERC, or that lower thickness DR, I believe you called it? If they were landing here at 25% lower than the international stuff, why didn't you just buy it? Then Professor Ross as well, it's another page you didn't cover, but you discuss on a page called Strategic Motivations, you discuss a kind of game theoretic analysis, and part of that, at the end of it, you say when industries are designated as potential beneficiaries of industrial policy, measures must be put in place to prevent suppliers to the selected sectors from capturing the lion's share of the reallocated public resources. If you could just comment on the types of measures that you would see needed to be put in place in the context of the canning industry. I understand that some of the downstream industries in steel, there's a problem with economies of scale, because the people who buy the steel aren't coordinated, and they ask for different grades and different thicknesses. I'm not sure if that applies to canning. If it does, is there potential for the canning sector to coordinate their purchases in terms of the grades and the thicknesses, or is it just a standard thickness that all of you use, and therefore your economies of scale are realized? The one, you know, you can say what you like about the prices, especially in Prof. Ross's graphs, but the AMSA prices, although sometimes higher or lower, are relatively stable. Now, that raises the question, if the basket of goods pricing strategy is adjusted monthly on exchange rates, I would expect them to move more than they appear to be moving in the graphs. But nonetheless, I'm sure the industry would agree there is something to be said for price stability. If you could comment on that, even as you shake your head. Then, lastly, just to the department, the terms of the basket of goods agreement. In your opinion, does the state have any leverage over that agreement? Who are the principals in that agreement? We talk about it as if it's something that we can intervene in, but I'm not sure we can, and I'd appreciate the department's views on that. That's it, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Harris. Honourable Kamala?
Thanks, Chairperson. On the second presentation, when I was looking at the slides talking about farming and manufacturing, there's a figure that has been showing in terms of employment, which is close to 20,000 farm workers as well as 14,000 on factory workers. My understanding is that the employment on these two combinations is usually being seasonal. I just want to check the sustainability of this employment. But secondly, Chair, I just want to second Honourable September in having the visits, the oversight visits, as she suggested. I want to second that. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Kamalo. Honourable Ariane Ambrosini.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Perhaps, as the Japanese would do, an apology and a word of thank you first. Apology for arriving late. I was in the hearing with the NEO, one of the largest consumers of steel, and a word of thank you for this continuous series of very important, stimulating public hearings we're having on the industry. And I say this because I've read what has been said. I didn't have the opportunity of listening to the actual presentation, but it seems to me, and this is a comment that will elicit a question, that there is a circularity in these hearings that we are hearing in respect of this industry and other fields of industry, which leads to a fundamental issue of policy coherence. It seems to me that we are trying to do a little of both options whenever two options are being presented. We want to respect the free market, but we're trying to give subsidies. We want to maintain import duties and tariff barriers, but we're trying to accelerate the process of breaking down monopolies, but we want also to keep monopolies. It seems to me that in this industry, as in many others we have been seized with, the issue is that of having a clear policy direction. If we want to be free marketeers, let's be free marketeers. If we don't, then let's give them the full measure of assistance they need. I don't think that the latter is an option, because we keep stealing money from the families to give it to the industry, and it's a short-term palliative. My suggestion, on which I would following up on what the Honourable Rabede was saying, quid agendi, what do we do? What are you asking us to do? Would be twofold, and I'm putting that as a comment to elicit an answer on whether it's just to have the courage of God at this situation of the juncture, the full measure, which is having the Reserve Bank dropping those bloody interest rates to zero, devaluing the rand, and trying to pull some of the subsidies, breaking the monopolies, and doing what the foundational aspects of free market would require of us to do. That's on the terms of what to be done. And for us as a committee, because we've been seized with these issues now for a while, and good leadership, good discussions, to have the courage for ourselves to adopt a resolution in that sense, and provide through Parliament, to the country, the leadership that the Department seems not necessarily having in trying to please everyone at the same time.
Thank you very much, Honourable Ambrosini. I see it's just getting on to 10:02, but I just have one or two questions myself, and that is with respect to the South African fruit and vegetable canning industry. You make a number of references in the agro-processing sector to the high employment of people, labour absorption. How does this compare to other countries and their labour absorption in this respect? The other one would be, right, I think the questions around the pricing, the various clarifications that have been sought have been covered, so I won't go down that route. Now, you keep on talking about the double reduced plated cans. I think probably a visit there would certainly enlighten us as to what a double reduced can is, plated can. However, exactly why can't we produce this or AMSA? Is it the technology we lack, the plants, the equipment, and what kind of cost would we be looking at for the capital equipment if in fact we decided that
this should be essential that we go down that particular route. And of course, a couple of the questions on the graphs have already been asked, but one is disturbed at some of the points you have made here about pineapples and things like that, that you're now trying to import them. On the face of it, one would certainly not like to go down that route. But nevertheless, the committee would need to study all these issues in depth. If we can have some of the questions have been directed to specific presentations, and others are of a more general nature. Thank you. Over to yourselves. I think the best thing is to raise a hand if you feel your presentation you'd like to respond. The questions you may answer in order or group your group cluster of questions. There were a number on pricing, for example, and so on and so forth. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks very much for those very thoughtful questions. I think they'll help us to supplement the information we've provided already substantially. What I'll do is take the questions in order, but when I encounter a question that was directly related to a later question, I'll then bunch them. So starting with the questions that were posed by the Honourable Fradevi, you asked which countries allow, and that's your word, import parity pricing. Of course, in most of the world, including this country, the view is that private companies are free to price however they wish. They're free to price in whatever way they think maximizes the return to their shareholders. It seems to me the key question is, under what circumstances would one expect companies to choose that kind of policy? The standard case economists have in mind for that sort of policy in a competitive market is companies would do that if the failure to do that with respect to their domestic price impacted world prices in such a way that it actually cost them money. Now, Mittal is a global player, and it has an interest in global prices. As I pointed out earlier in the slide, the South African domestic market is too small to have any significant impact on global price. So what we're dealing with here in part is just the consequence of being a small market ourselves that is part of a much larger international market. It would certainly be a major departure from our general attitude to the freedom of private companies for us to order AMSA to price in a different way than it does. So to my mind, barring a very kind of radical rethink of the sort of way in which we manage the political economy in this country, the right public policy question is, how do we deal with the fact that AMSA has the incentives to price in this way? I'll return to some of those political economy themes in the context of some later questions. The Honourable Fradevi also asked about the possibility of a sort of a mini-mill technology. Some of those questions were reiterated by the Chair and by some other Honourable members. There's a direct relationship between the so-called mini-mill technology and the thinner steel. So the only country in the world where mini-mill production of thin cast steel has dominated the industry, has become the norm in the industry, is the USA. And that's significantly based on the very, very big, on other surrounding efficiencies in their infrastructure and the big economies of scale that they have. So in a small market like this that's distant from other markets, these considerations become quite dominant. We investigated last, it's simply not clear, and I suspect it's probably not the case, that at this point in time, we would easily be able to attract much investment to the construction of our own U.S.-style steel industry. We did investigate last year the possibility that the canners in South Africa could directly import cans based on thin slab steel, or import thin slab thin cast steel, or tin plate from thin cast steel, that could be used by the South African canners, South African can makers. And our conclusion at that time was that that was a potentially, that is and was a potentially viable option for the industry. That is, that the costs could be reduced, and those cans or that tin plate could be competitively sourced. The problem, of course, is that that's a portentous kind of step, because it constitutes a challenge to the way in which the supply chain is currently organized in South Africa. But in our opinion, it's an option well worth looking at. There are several of the honorable members asked questions about how we arrived at our current estimate of the relationship between AMSA's current price and the current basket. Very simple procedure we use. We started from the size of AMSA's October 2009 price reduction compared to the basket then. And we estimate that for AMSA to have brought its price down to be entirely in conformity with the value of the basket in October, the price increase should have been about 39%. But we know that it was less than that. Right? It was a little less than 30%. So then we ask ourselves, do we have any evidence that there has been a decrease in AMSA's price since October 2009 relative to the basket? We can, of course, calculate the basket ourselves for any period. We also, the other data we have is we know what's happened to the canner. That is the price of cans to the canner. And that has risen by about 5%. We don't find any evidence in any data that are available to us that there has been significant movement, adjustment in AMSA's prices. So when we put all that together, we come to the conclusion that AMSA's current price is probably about 8% higher than the basket. An honorable member asked what we would need. I made reference to ways in which we could make a more exact estimate based on independent evidence by doing a standard industry price in sectoral pricing survey. And the honorable member said, what resources are needed? The main resources that are needed for that, a few months and a couple of hardworking, intelligent, underpaid graduate students. The usual pay we do things. Because it's not rocket science, there's a medley of signals one can pick up from other rates and magnitudes in the economy, and from those one can, there's standard statistical methods for deriving quite exact estimates, and they have the advantage that they're independent estimates, not just based on asking companies to tell us what their pricing strategies. They don't force us to go with a stick and try and make companies divulge proprietary information, which we should be reluctant to do, which government should be reluctant to do. But these estimates have a very standard methodology, and they're very reliable. There is the information hard to get, but I just alluded to that. Companies are entitled to protect proprietary information. Companies may release data when they think it's compatible with with the interest of their shareholders and with their, and again, that's the right they have. But as I, my previous point made, there are ways to inform those things very reliably without having to force companies to inappropriately divulge. A number of honorable members asked about trade policy. The people from the department are here who can no doubt comment on that. Of course, I have opinions. It's true that were we negotiating a trade treaty, comprehensive trade treaty with the European Union now, as a result of greater 10 years of experience, we probably would negotiate a little more firmly than we did. Nobody that I know of thinks that that treaty is an ideal treaty by any means. Of course, you have, one must ask a larger question. To scrap the treaty, or to become very, very aggressive in trying to renegotiate it, is a policy option we should address not just with respect to that treaty, but with respect to the larger credibility of our overall trade strategy. Chances are that the EU's importance as a trade partner for South Africa will, over the long run, decline. The EU is probably, they are our most important trade partner now, but the share of the EU in the world economy is shrinking, especially as its population ages and as its competitiveness declines. So one should look forward, and not just narrowly at the EU treaty. Certainly, Marcus, and this relates to another question that some honorable members asked. The Honorable September asked, how does the steel cost issue compare in magnitude to other problems confronting the industry, for example, the exchange rate? And then, of course, and this is where it ties to the EU treaty issue, market access. Access to our biggest market. Europe is our biggest market for canned fruit. Suppose we fixed the steel price problem or some public policy intervention did something about that, would that make the, in itself make the industry competitive? Would that address the industry's biggest problem? The answer is no. The industry's biggest problem at present is limited market access. In my opinion, as expressed in previous reports that I have submitted both to the industry and to the department, I've expressed the view that in the long run, that a long-run strategy that's absolutely crucial for the fruit canning industry is to work very aggressively to build markets outside of the EU, in particular in Asia. Right? One of the things we know is that as populations get richer, their consumption of canned fruit declines in favor of fresh fruit. And so we did some estimation work to try and figure out exactly where that turning point is, right? We wouldn't turn around India and other market populations are getting richer. Well, I wouldn't want to do a whole investment in new markets just in time to have them abandon canned fruit because they're now rich enough to afford fresh fruit. However, reassuringly, and this is a crucial part of the basis of my recommendation that my finding that the industry is potentially competitive if we can solve some of these problems. We tried to identify the turning point when, in terms of wealth, consumer wealth, when canned fruit consumption starts to drop. And the so-called brick markets are miles away from that point yet. So there's every reason to expect at least a couple of decades, if not more, of continued and quite substantial increases in canned fruit consumption in those markets. And my own view is that our trade policy should interact with industrial policy in this area. If we want them swimming together and complementing each other, we should focus less on Europe, simply because there's no evidence that the EU is going to be amenable to significant renegotiation. But we should be concentrating both the industrial policy and the trade policy on those new markets. In the context of that policy, then measures to help the industry reduce its input costs, of which steel is the biggest, as NASA's indicated, is the biggest, single biggest component, measures to reduce, to help the industry with that problem could be very significant. years. I have reviewed those data in the past, but I didn't bring them today and I didn't review them. For this presentation, the industry may be able to say more about that in greater detail, so I think I'll defer that question to them. The Honorable Harris asked about price dynamics over a larger frame. So the thrust of his question was, I showed you periods in which the AMSA price has been significantly higher than the basket, and we suspect it now is such a time. Should we be focusing too narrowly, unfairly narrowly, that the cherry picking a period of which the current one just happens to be one, in which the AMSA price wanders above the basket, but maybe over the long run, what we've got here is just a stable price, whereas the basket jumps around, and price stability is good. And so it's not really fair to the industry to possibly times when they wander above that. I think not. The underlying problem here, I think, is that AMSA's incentives with respect to the way it prices have a trend, and that trend has been in the direction of higher prices than the formula suggested, than application of the formula suggested in the past. So I think we've got a market structure problem. We've got a market structure problem from the point of view of wanting to maintain the health of our export industry that uses steel. The Honorable Harris asked, why didn't the industry turn to imports? I've indicated that it was my recommendation that they should about a year ago. We can only ask the industry what barriers they've identified and what they see as the primary problems with turning to imports during periods when they find the AMSA price too high. And of course, the can makers play a crucial part in this story. Randall Harris noted a slide that I chose not to dwell on for fear that it would have taken up too much of my presentation time, in which I commented on strategic responses to industrial policy. This is actually quite important, so I'm pleased that the honorable member drew attention to that slide, which is in your pack. One of the key changes in the policy environment over the past few years, and this relates then directly to the price stability issue, is that we have moved in the direction, in South Africa, of greater emphasis on industrial policy. And we did that deliberately. We did that with our eyes open. Right? It's an explicit self-conscious choice. We need to recognize when we change that background policy condition for industries, industries will of course respond. And good policy must take that into account. If I'm supplying a fundamental input good to a bunch of industries who I think are going to receive government assistance, and I've got strong pricing power, what my shareholders will expect me to do, if I'm serving them properly, right, will expect management of that company to do, will be to price in such a way that you try to capitalize on whatever, as much as you can, on whatever new government resources are being contributed to the sector. So if I think I want my share, if the government is going to be putting resources into the sector, then all industries participating in that sector will rightly, should be expected to try to capture their share. And one of the ways in which you capture your share is hold a bit, if you're an input supplier of a major input good, is hold a bit of a price umbrella up. And of course government should anticipate that. I mean, industry, it's a familiar idea. This was implicit in the honorable Anderson's question. Once you start down the road to industrial policy, if that's the road you take, you must recognize that you're getting into a deep strategic game, and there's going to be lots of other things you have to do. One industrial policy leads to another. Right? It's a little bit of industrial policy just to stake markets. So if you're going to do it, then you have to apply your mind and ask yourself how the industry participants will respond to your industrial policy. You've got to look for the unintended consequences, and you've got to have other elements of your industrial policy to cope with them. That's one of the reasons lots of economists are nervous about industrial policy. I am such a nervous economist. And that's really my answer to the question about the philosophical or consistency or philosophical underpinnings or the policy coherence. Whether we could drop interest rates and let the market rip, as the honorable member suggests, and back off industrial policy is perhaps the biggest question facing our policy choices. That's a fundamental policy choice, undoubtedly well beyond the remit, I take it, of the current mandate of this inquiry. But of course, it is a big underlying economic issue on which economists have opinions.
Sorry to interrupt you, Professor Ross, but I do know someone from the fruit, vegetable and canning industry needs to leave at 12 and no later than 20 past. And as we are there, I think we'll need to just come back to you.
As it happens, I've come to the very end of my list. So.
Well, now, how strategic of myself. Thanks.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm the one who has to leave, but I'm going to Paris to sell canned fruit, not for entertainment. So please excuse me. But I just want to cover some of the points that are industry-specific and some of the points that Professor Ross did not cover because they affect industry. And maybe my colleague from, or my competitor rather, from the other company, Rhodes Food Group, could add to it. The first, with regard to all questions regarding employment, I think it's our responsibility through the association to give the committee details of employment trends over the last 10 years, specifically focus on the closure of the Eastern Cape pineapple canning factory, and also the percentage of the rand value of the employment, and do a comparison with other countries as well. It is a highly labor-intensive industry. We estimate that about 20% of our turnover goes to labour, which is quite a high number. And we will be showing how the industry, because of the lack of clarity about its future and the volatility of all sorts of factors, has not reached its potential, which it has a very big growth potential. If I could start with the first point that I think Honourable September at the back made, is canned prices the only problem of the industry? And I think it's a very valid point to put it into context, and the answer is a very emphatic no, it's not the only problem of the industry. The fundamental problem of the industry, whether one is exporting or whether one is producing locally, does boil down to the exchange rate, and I think we need to face up to it. The uncompetitive RAN, which is more eloquently expressed through organizations like the Manufacturing Circle, together with higher than South African inflation rate regulatory price increases, has put both companies that produce food for the local market facing a flood of imports, and exporters are facing a double whammy of having to compete with an unfavorable exchange rate. However, having said that, canned is the single biggest contributor to our cost base, and that is the focus of today's meeting. In response to the Honourable Harris's point, and I must apologise if I got a little bit excited and I was nodding my head when you were speaking, there are a number of issues with regarding tin plate pricing in South Africa. The first one is that the very own graph that AMSA has created, the so-called basket, we reject that concept of a basket. The weighting is irrelevant for South Africa. We do not compete against the United States in canned food. We don't compete against the UK. But we do compete against China. So if we were to do our own basket, the very good work that Professor Ross has done will show that AMSA's pricing, compared to the countries we compete against, is not just 8%, but it's probably 38%. Fact is that 10 years ago, 100% of the cans that were used in South Africa were South African steel, and which is South African coal and South African electricity and South African labor. We've now reached the stage where I would estimate that 60-70% of cans used by the South African industry use South African steel, the other is imported. And I have no doubt that come 12 months, if we're sitting here, we will find that maybe 50% is South African steel, 30% is imported steel, and 20% are imported cans. A small point that the Honourable Harris made is the 25% advantage in our presentation is on an ex works basis. Now, we can import cans at 10% cheaper, and we may very well do that, but our problem is not that. The problem is that our competitor, who is sitting in the EU, or is sitting in China, or is sitting in Australia, is buying cans at 25% cheaper, and if that's 30% of your costs, you can see the effect that has. Employment we covered. The third point with regard to steel is the question of technology. Now, there is no question that AMSA or the wider global group does have the technology because they make double reduced plate all over the world. And I think it's incumbent on yourselves, Madam Chair, to ask them why they're not bringing that technology to South Africa. Our understanding, and I can't talk on their behalf, is that if they're making it elsewhere, the market in South Africa is not sufficient and the investment requirement to make that type of product is too high for the potential returns. There's not a question that we don't, that there is no, is lack of know-how or somebody sitting with a secret formula, but rather a willingness to invest in the double reduced technology. I think the fundamental question, which was the very first question that was asked by the Honourable Hadebe, is that what do you want us to do? And that's a very valid point because we can talk about it. We have made concrete and definitive suggestions. Whilst all the problems can be summarized with the exchange rate, if the argument is that little can be done, the exchange rate will be what the exchange rate will be, then the answer certainly lies in a more aggressive application of industrial policy to ensure that long-term industries do not suffer or do not scale down as a result of short-term fluctuations. So to answer your question, it really is an application, a much more aggressive application of industrial policy measures, notwithstanding the problems that Professor Rossa has highlighted of those consequences. Madam Chair, I think that answers the questions. Just the one last point on trade policy. As an industry body, we're very close to DTI, and we're certainly very happy with the work that the DTI officials have done in trying to get us a better deal with Europe. Whilst we appreciate that we do need to go to seek and create new markets in our products, whether we like it or not, Europe does remain a huge market for us, and getting a better deal is essential, and we're working very closely to DTI and have a very good relationship with the officials in trying to get us a better deal.
Thank you very much. I should have thanked you very much as well, Professor Ross.
I think most of the points raised by the Honourable Members have been covered. I've been going through the list and ticking them off, and I think the major exercise, certainly from our side, would be the impact on labour, and I think that question came up from a number of the Members. We will certainly prepare a comprehensive reply or response in terms thereof, and we will then circulate that via the Committee Secretary. I think the other point that came up, and I think it was again from the Honourable September, was an oversight visit to the industry. And I think from our side, we formally extend that invitation to the committee to come and visit our industry. We welcome that. In fact, it is a point that both Mr. Hermans and I have spoken about before with regard to a visit to the industry. So you're most welcome, and we formally extend that invitation to you. Thank you.
Well, I expect we're all looking for fruit for our Christmas cake. I don't know if there's anyone in your team that wished to add, because I did see at one point yourself. Sir, maybe did you
Perry, did you raise your hand? Then you're very welcome to comment.
No, I think, Madam Chair, thank you. I think it's been covered by my colleagues. Particularly it was around the issue of labor and the fact that we do a comprehensive report which would also cover the issue of seasonality, which was raised by, you know, the seasonality of labor as raised by one of the members.
Thank you very much. I do see, you know, I know some members need to hasten to the airport, but, if, you know, I don't know if that's your entire team going to Paris or one yet. So, in fact, you could quietly just excuse yourself when your time is necessary. Honourable September, it's a short follow-up, I got the impression. And there was another short follow-up, the Honourable Kotze, was that correct? Very short, yes.
Chair, thank you.
No, I will come to DTI at the end.
Chair, it's not a follow-up, it's just to say that one of my questions has not been answered, the one on alternative.
Yes, perhaps you'll just mention...
Yeah, it's true that the industry has increasingly been characterized by the packaged food industry has been increasingly characterized by alternatives, plastic, for example, and there have been some adoptions of such alternative packaging by South African fruit packers. However, those alternatives tend to characterize only the small, premium, high profit margin part of the market. They're very, very important, therefore. I mean, those alternative packaging, that's one of the key routes to the real high profit bit. But it's just a bit. As I emphasized in my presentation, in the case of the South African industry, you wouldn't be able to compete in the high premium plastic packaging part of the market if we weren't achieving the economies of scale that we get from the much lower profit but much higher volume canning part of the market. No one I know of who is an expert on this industry thinks that the fruit can is on the way out as the basic bulk staple product for that mass part of the market.
And if we can just get both of those very short questions coming up right now. Honourable Kotze, Honourable Harris, and that we'll then shift to DTI.
Thank you, Chair. I did ask a question there. In their report, the can industry, they're saying they're investigating the feasibility of own can making facility. I mean, and I ask, what do they have in mind?
Honourable Harris?
I did ask a version of this to the department, and I hope they answer, but I just appreciate Professor Ross's views on this. For a steel producer in a small open economy, it's rational to price at import parity pricing. Now, it appears that the pricing agreement from 2006, I think it was, with the basket of other prices was some kind of concession in response to pressure from the states or moral suasion or... Obviously, the industry believes that the basket is wrong and perhaps there could be more pressure applied to adjust the basket to reflect our competitors. But what other, for steel producers in small open economies, what other strategies could the government take in terms of, is there anything else we can do other than just apply pressure?
Right, and then we'll get your responses, either one of you, from the presentation before DTI. We would like short responses now because we are, of course, awaiting another presentation.
Yes, I think the most useful and sustainable kind of policy response that could be made would be around the facilitation of creation of new steelmaking capacity in the country. So, you know, if what we've got is an investment barrier, but if it were possible to change the nature of the supply chain from steel to the fruit canners through some capital investment, Right? That is, if there was a one-off capital investment that could get through a bottleneck, right? And could, for example, bring to South Africa the possibility of making more, but making cheaper, thinner steel. That's the kind of assistance that industrial policy could in principle provide. Of course, one has to test very carefully to make sure that one is not creating a situation of permanent dependence. But I don't, in my opinion, nobody has shown that, that a more efficient domestic steel production facility is unsustainable in South Africa. What I think is clear is that there's a substantial speed bump to get over, and the private sector is unlikely to concentrate the capital to get over it.
Just in response to the question around own can making facilities, I think as an industry body, it's very difficult for me to comment with regard to an individual company perhaps considering such a venture. So we're not really privy to the detail of that individual company that may be considering to do so, because they would probably do so in the interest of their competitive advantage. So as an industry body, we don't have the detail. However, we are aware that there are discussions underway with regard to potentially looking into the feasibility of establishing own can-making facilities. And those discussions are underway between the DTI and the IDC and potential individual companies. So as an industry body, that's really all the detail I have at this point in time. Thank you.
I just want to reiterate that we would welcome written responses that could detail that any areas that you feel can be added to, and of course there are others that perhaps you have agreed to come back to us with. The committee secretary will just give you a deadline on that. Now if we can shift to the Department of Trade and Industry. I thought you may be interested in hearing what the department had to say, Professor. Mr. Nimrod Zulk.
Thank you, Chair. Let me start off with the questions posed by Honourable Kotze in September. Although the division that we represent is not the division of the department that undertakes the trade negotiations, I can make some broad points about the trade deals with the EU. And I think the trade deal with the EU reflects, like any other trade agreement, the outcome of a negotiation, which in turn reflects the relative economic power of, you know, the two parties to those trade negotiations. And I think it's the nature of these negotiations that you never get everything that you want, but the question is, are you better with the deal than without the deal? And I think that's an entirely legitimate set of issues for the, you know, for the portfolio committee to engage with. On the specific issue of what is our market access to the EU, my understanding is that we face a 10% duty on canned goods into the EU within a particular quota, so up to a certain quantity, and then if we go beyond that quota, then we face a 20% tariff. I think the next point to make is that we don't believe that there's a silver bullet to the issues that face or to the competitiveness and sustainability of any particular industry. But what is critical is that we need to, as robustly as we can, tackle every major impediment to the sustainability and competitiveness of an industry. All else being equal, I think it's clear to us that in general the issue of steel pricing is an impediment to the development of a number of downstream industries. And the extent to which it is an impediment is largely part of what is the proportion of steel as a percentage of the input costs that the industry faces. If it's low, then maybe you can offset it in other ways. If it's high, then it's very significant. Now, I think that from the canning industry side, They're saying 30% of the input costs of a can, and that in turn is a very large proportion of that is made up by the cost of the tin plate. So it's a very serious issue for the industry, clearly. In our presentations to the portfolio committee, we indicated that across a much broader range of metal-consuming industries, metal products and machinery equipment industries, when you take into account both the direct and indirect proportion of steel as a percentage of input costs, that ranges across a number of subsectors from around 23% to as high as 43%. So clearly, in a whole range of downstream industries, the pricing of steel is absolutely fundamental. Of course, not detracting from all the other things that we have to do, including negotiating robust trade agreements with our trading partners. Turning then to the, I think this flows then into the question that's posed by the Honourable Harris. I think the first thing is to clarify that the 2006 basket pricing mechanism that AMSA put in place did not reflect an agreement between ourselves and AMSA. It was a unilateral decision on AMSA's part, which in turn was informed by a commitment that they had made immediately prior to the merger or their takeover, let's say, of the majority shareholding in ISCO in 2004, where they committed as soon as possible after achieving majority shareholding in ISCO to put in place a pricing model that would raise the downstream usage of steel both in the domestic and the export market. Now, the reason that we did not agree to this unilateral 2005 basket pricing mechanism is that, in our view, we did not believe that it would achieve the outcome of that 2004 commitment to raise the usage of steel for both downstream and export consumption. Now, what is our rationale for that point of view? First of all, when we track steel prices, and we presented this to the committee over the period 2004 to 2009, we found that whether or not the basket price was in place, except for the year 2008, AMSA's prices for hot rolled coil were consistently above the world average, generally in the highest quartile of world pricing, and in some years, 2005 and 2008, the highest in the world in the countries that we compared to. So our analysis of that indicates that the basket price was not sufficient to give effect to the 2004 commitment. In any event, when we try to replicate the AMSA basket price by our own unweighted average of the four countries that they include in their basket, we cannot consistently replicate it. So it's not clear to us how consistently the basket price is actually implemented. With a great degree of openness on their side to add, and to alter. So even their own unilateral action was not consistently stuck to. And then in 2009, again, unilaterally, they departed from their own basket price, which I think then, turns to, well, before I answer the last question, if we look at the long-term trend of downstream steel usage in South Africa, how much steel is bought and processed by downstream manufacturing companies, we've looked at this over the long term, 1974 through to, I think, 2008, 2009. there's no long-term increasing trend of downstream steel usage in South Africa. It fluctuates between about 4 and 6 million tons. There obviously was we moved towards the higher end of that band, particularly in the recent period, let's say the last 3 or 4 years, when there was very, very high levels of public investment expenditure. It subsequently come down in 2009, you know, as a consequence of the economic crisis. So we don't see in place a pricing mechanism that is fundamentally going to change that long-term trend. And therefore, the work of the interdepartmental task team is precisely mandated to say what is going to shift us. You know, what kind of mechanisms do we need beyond the long period of moral suasion that we've attempted to actually achieve lower steel prices? Now, I think we agree with Professor Ross that first prize is more competition in the domestic market, more steel investment. To that end, we're working very closely with the IDC, they believe that it is possible to establish additional steel production capacity using minimal technology, so smaller and more focused technology than the big integrated plants that AMSA deploys. Obviously, that takes some time. We do also have to bear in mind that South Africa is almost geographically unique in the world. And this gives market power, particularly where a company has, you know, 80% plus market share in flat steel products. And the reason is that even in other parts of the world, generally, even if it's a relatively small country and market and it's open, even if there's not domestic competition, there's genuinely regional competition. Now, we are located in an under-industrialized part of the world. The southern African market does not have competing steel plants operating in. We don't have these in neighboring countries like Zimbabwe and Mozambique and Botswana and so forth. So we lack that regional competition effect. That gives rise to a very high degree of pricing power and the ability to put in place very high import parity margins, because your alternatives are then shipping steel from far away, you know, Europe, Latin America, Asia, whatever your choice of imports as an alternative, the shipping costs are high. So the task team then is looking at a range of measures. New steel investment is obviously one of them. We're looking at, you know, do we not need to strengthen some of the Competition Act to deal with some of the very specific conditions that we face in South Africa? Are there trade measures that we can put in place, and so forth? So that, broadly speaking, is the work of the task team, which no doubt we will be called back by the committee to come and present once it's been processed by the ministers.
Thank you very much, Mr. Zalk. Thank you very much indeed. And I know that Professor Ross needs to go and, just add to the knowledge and share his knowledge with some undergraduates and probably graduates. Thank you very much. We hope you can return to us at some point, because this is an ongoing issue that we certainly need to be engaging with very vigorously. And we'll just see what sort of time there is on our program regarding oversight visits. Thank you very much. And just to a bit of housekeeping, I know you can see everything down there, and the last thing we need is a sort of bottom sail rush. We need a rather measured approach to the table, one or two, rolling type of tea break, and also comfort break. So take your comfort breaks one at a time, and a couple, two or three at the table, without clanging anything. So if we can you know, and I know we're all thirsty, all of us, and are perhaps a little hungry. Professor de Klerk, I think it is, Dr. de Klerk, probably the title professor doesn't come amiss, go amiss anyway. Dr. de Klerk, executive director of the Institute, South African Institute of Steel Construction. This isn't the first time he's been with us. So thank you for returning to us to share a couple of thoughts on the matter.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
May I ask how much time we have?
Well, certainly, I'm not cutting you short. You've been far too patient. So, but of course, we don't expect you to continue till 3 o'clock. You know, the idea is to do this as constructively as possible in as short a time without overlooking your core point.
Thank you. We feel a bit squeezed in, I must admit. Despite the fact that we are by far the biggest sector using steel. Steel is an important material. There's a saying that if it's not made of steel, it's made using steel. Even if you look at this carpet or that bottle or your clothes or whatever, everything has been made using steel, even if it was not made of steel. Steel enables industrial development. It is also, despite everything that's said about the price, is a remarkably inexpensive product. 1 kilogram of steel costs about the same as a kilogram of coke if you buy it in 2 liter quantities. The coke, not the steel. So I get the impression that that bottled water is in any case more expensive than both steel or coke per kilogram. Steel is also remarkably sustainable both from a social, economic, environmental point of view. The last point might surprise you that steel is so environmentally friendly. We can go into that argument on another day. There is an interesting bit of information which I want to show you here, which is how much steel does South Africa use per person, which is about 108, and how many tons per $1 million of our gross national product. And so we use about 108 kilograms per person in the country and about 19 tons per million of GDP. That, incidentally, what I didn't put here is the world average. The world average is about 180 kilograms per person and about 20 tons per million of GDP. So we're, in terms of tons per GDP, we're on par with the average of the world, but in terms of kilograms per person, we're behind. But I think the interesting ones on this graph, on this table, are actually Thailand, Egypt, and Iran, both and all three of them using a lot more steel per, certainly in terms of million, per $1 million of GDP than South Africa does. And to me that indicates that there is considerable room for growth in the use of steel in South Africa, and I think I agree with what Mr. Zolk said just a little bit ago. About 40% of all steel is used in construction. That relates to about, that implies about 2.4 million tons of flat and long product, as it's stated. And we estimate that about 80,000 people are involved in the production of steel products for the construction industry. It is also, aside from the fact that it's used there, it's also an enabling industry. If you want to start a mine, if you want to start a factory, you want to do whatever, the first thing is you have to put up a steel structure, and then you can start putting your machines up there and your productive plant and so on. In terms of structures that we produce from steel, we have buildings and bridges and so on, but if you look around there, the list I have, petrochemical plant for the mining industry a huge consumer of steel when it gets to building a new mine, complete with the surface works and the plant that process the ore and so on. So in terms of the whole industrial area, very, very important. But there are also products which are produced which go into construction. Roof and wall cladding, that's your corrugated iron type stuff, bolts and screws, your secondary steel products. In other words, people that buy steel, normally in the form of some sort of plate, and make something out of it. And pipes is a good example, with the fencing and security, and then all kinds of things, from windows and door frames to all little things that that go into buildings. Where we fit into the structure of the industry, if you look at the top right there, you see the mills obviously producing the steel. That's mill is obviously ArcelorMittal, Hytel, those guys. Some go into the hollow sections, that's the pipes and things and the cold formed and so forth. A lot goes, I would say, 60-70% goes to the merchants and service centers. That's the Max Steels, Trident, and so on of this world. And they hold this steel there, they buy in big quantities, hold it there, and sell to in smaller quantities on demand to other people. The steel contractor is the guy sitting right in the middle. He's the guy who takes that steel, makes something out of it that looks like a beam and column. He cuts it to length, he drills holes in it, he welds things, welds pieces together, and so on. And then the main contractor is the guy who actually put the project together on the ground, be that a shopping center, be that whatever it is. And of course, products are provided directly to him too. Some of the stuff that, just a few pictures to show you, this is just a crane, but it represents also all the various things where steel are used in industrial applications, as I mentioned, in the mining industry, petrochemical industry, whatever else. That building there was built with South African steel, fabricated in Germiston, and shipped out to Dubai. Transmission lines, I'll come back to transmission line pylons. A very important, not a very large percentage, but still an important market segment. That what you see there is all steel. Soccer City, Nelson Mandela Bridge, made in steel, and so on. Getting to our institute's activities, we're involved in all kinds of technical things, developing the technology of the industry, education and training, very important, improving this industry in general, and also interacting with decision makers. But then we come to two things which I put in yellow, because the price of steel has a direct impact on this. And the first being, promote the use of steel, which is to do market development on behalf of the steel industry, the downstream industry in the construction or in the area of construction. And the last point here is defending the home market. That means essentially that whenever there's a project that's there's a threat that this might go to some external supplier, that we go to the clients, we convince them that they can get that product cheaper and better and more reliable and so on, from South African sources. And we have had remarkable success in this regard. As for the Australian steel construction industry, which is very similar to ours, they've just about keeled over and left it to the Chinese to provide their mining industry and whatever, and buildings, etc. And we've been
remarkably successful in this regard. We're also, through our Export Council, very involved in export promotion, again shown in yellow because clearly the price of steel is very important there. And I'm not going to go into detail in the things that we actually do in terms of promoting exports, but we're certainly very, very active in that field. Now, let us look at what impact the price of steel actually has in our field. If you look at fabricated structural steel, those are one of those big things. It's a bridge or a structure standing there as it's erected on the ground, and before you put cladding on and all those sort of thing, about 40% of the cost of that product as it stands there is made up of what's paid to the steel merchants. And don't forget the merchants. They take off quite a bit over the top of what the ArcelorMittals and the Heifels charge for that product. It might be a very interesting thing to look at. But in any case, 40% of that value of that product consists of that. Now, if you look at the whole thing, now the whole building stands there. It's complete with machines, with everything else. You would find that the basic cost of that thing would only constitute about between 2% and 8% of the final product. That Burj Al Arab building in Dubai that I showed you, the carpets were more expensive than the steel structure for that thing. It gives you a sense of proportion. Now, in terms of domestic competition, in other words, and I'm still talking about structural steel, competition from other products and between us, the effect of the increase in the price of steel has been very little. During 2007-2008, the price of structural steel, or all steel of course, went up hugely in line with what was happening on the world market. And on top of that, our industry was coining it because they were adding, they were charging whatever they could get, obviously, at the time. So, and that actually demonstrates that there is great elasticity, or significant elasticity, to the general price. Of course, the competition between the guys is very much there. Clearly, when it gets to international competitiveness, that's an entirely different story. That is threats from imports and on the one hand, and exports on the other. When you ever look at products made of steel, such as tube and pipe, or bolts, or roof cladding, etc., then you would find that imports and substitute products or other materials, there they become very important and a real threat to the industry. So in those fields, the price is actually more important. But I just, again, in terms of trying to give you a bit of a feel for the importance of the price of steel, if you look at a car, a motor car, there's about 400 kilograms of steel supplied by ArcelorMittal in a typical car made in South Africa. Now, if they increase the price by some 20% or 1,000 rands, that would have only a 400 rand impact on the price of the car. In other words, it's like moving up with the quality of the radio sort of thing. It's really not important. A practical case we've just looked at is a cement plant. I'll come back to that in a way. Costing about 1.8 billion rands, with 5,000 tons of structural steel in it, and that amounts to about 5,000 rands of steel, or 50 million rands of steel, I'm sorry, at merchant prices, not at ArcelorMittal prices, and that amounts to, well, 2.7% of the product. So even if you put up the price, you know, the percentage increase in the project is really insignificant. And like, you know, people won't decide not to build that plant just because steel has become important, more expensive. But now you look at another project, which is the power pylons for the Eskom power lines, and there the steel costs about, again, 40%, that sort of order of magnitude, of the final product. Now, if you look at the cost of importing those products from India, where they are imported from, and it's a real threat to us, you would find that ArcelorMittal would have to reduce their price to just more than half, or by just less than half, about, in other words, to 3,500 tons. Now, clearly that is not feasible in anybody's books. So, which just tells you there are other things that are playing a role here. And it may be, to some extent, the productivity of our local industry. And we believe, certainly, that it's got a lot to do with dumping from the other side. I'd like to also give, show you these figures here. And importantly here, I'll just show you that in 2009, there was about 24,000 tons of structural steel, fabricated, value-added structural steel, imported. A total of 400,000 tons of manufactured products, steel products, and that doesn't include cars and fridges and things which are actually another product altogether. These are steel products which have to then become something else or built into something else. And about 7.4 billion rands of steel products were imported in 2009. That is big. And in fact, in 2008, it was 10 billion rands worth of... Now, if you look at the exports, firstly, the exports of structural steel, 144,000. Let me just go back. In other words, 24,000 was imported, 144,000 was exported. So, in terms of that, we're really doing good. We export a lot more than we import. But at the same time, if you look at the total exports of steel, it amounted to 8.2 billion, which is better than the 7.4 billion, but I mean, you know, it's still far too much that, let's say, far too much that was imported than was exported. I actually repeat those figures, but what is interesting is that the exported product, on average, was only sold at 16,400 rand per ton. That's a rather small value add. And the imported product came in at an average of 20,000 rand a ton, which is at least better. On structural, as I mentioned, about six times more exported than imported, and of that, our exports, 50% went into about 40 African countries, but in total, we exported to 115 countries worldwide. Now, you can only export if you're actually competitive in those other places. So, this speaks of a competitive industry. And the average product selling price was about 21,000 rand a ton, which I can tell you is quite a good South African price. a domestic price would be of a similar order. Now, ANZA provides a certain export incentive, and basically it amounts to more or less the following, that they say, okay, you want to export to, choose a country, Turkey. Say, okay, let's find out what's the price of steel in Turkey, and they subsidize you in terms of any price differential and the cost of exports, of transport, as though you're buying your product there. And but Hartel doesn't provide that sort of incentive in any case, and whereas a lot of structural steel actually come out of the Heifeld stable. Now, of course, other things, productivity, quality, technology, your delivery, your reliability, the service that you provide, the whole professionalism of what you do is just as important in an export situation as is the price. This is just a graph showing the that in 2008 we hit a very high level in terms of exports, and it dropped down to about 144,000 tons last year. And we think, on the basis of the figures available to us, that we'll have about a similar export quantity this year. 144,000 amounts to, that per year, is about 12,000 tons a month, and that's about 15, if you have about 15 tons in a truck, that's an average truck, it means 25 trucks, or truckloads, effectively, leave the country each year, each day of the year. It's sort of staggering to just think how much material it is, but certainly we'd like to see it enhanced. Now, ladies and gentlemen, when we look at our trading partners in each case, whether you look at India or you look at Brazil or whatever, you will find that they subsidize and they assist exports and they tax and they deter imports. That is just how it is, and so much for free market. We have certainly too few incentives for exports, and we certainly have too few protections against imports. You know, when it gets to the power line situation, a year ago it was identified by the Minister of Trade and Industry that this is an industry which is critical to be protected. And we were asked to prepare an application for a levy on imported power line pylons. The process is complex enough that it took us about 6 months to get that 4 months to get that thing done, that application done, and it's been now since April that the process has been running, and now finally this month it got into the Gazette. So it took a year from the minister identifying a need to protect an industry until that thing was in the Gazette. And of course, now, you know, we'd like to see what the outcome will be. And the whole process we experienced as one that was not, let's say, friendly. I mean, not that the individuals were unfriendly, but it's not a process at all. Thank you for coming, and, you know, let's see what we can do and how we can help you. In fact, the whole approach is, you know, why should we be doing this sort of thing? It goes against our grain in any case. And then, of course, there's the other question of import or permits being granted to import projects complete. And that's where the cement plant comes into the thing. And where, you know, the Chinese will be delivering that project complete with labor, with everything. We say even they bring the sex workers along, sort of thing. But and they will be paid in China, so number one, so that they so it will not be clear what each individual is paid, because if they were to be paid here, they would have to pay minimum wages. But secondly, also, they won't have one rand to go down to the cafe to buy themselves a packet of cigarettes, for example. So the impact on the South African economy will be zilch, and yet that permit is being granted to proceed this way. Now, the state of the local industry was that until 2008, things have been going great, and this industry responded vigorously in terms of investing and building extra capacity. We're very involved and have been with Competitive Supplier Development Program of Eskom, Railways, Petro-SA, whatnot. But then, of course, government spending stopped, and at the same time, the private sector also went into a steep decline in terms of its capital investment. The mining industry, of course, it was great uncertainty and really stopped investing, whereas the South Americans, things are really going great guns in terms of their investment in new mines. Of course, the power stations are still running. The strong rand and the volatile rand really wreaks havoc with exports, of course. Very, very big issue. And I can tell you that certainly there have been a lot of job losses and a number of companies going bust. And the result of that slow reaction on the power lines has been that one of the very largest companies in that field has closed its doors. It just said it can't wait anymore. It doesn't look as though we are committed to that. But we believe that there are all kinds of opportunities for our industry. I list a few there. But the important thing is exports. I believe our industry is bigger than the demands or than the base demand of South Africa for steel and construction. We have to export. And there are lots of export opportunities. Of course, resist imports. In terms of conclusions, yes, the steel price is an important determinant of a successful steel construction industry, but there are also many other factors that have an even larger effect. In terms of domestic competition, I mentioned that there is a rather level playing field for structural steel, but there's real concern about competition from imports and other materials when one gets to products like pipes and whatever else. Exports a growth opportunity. And steel prices, clearly very important in terms of exports, and of course at the same time the exchange rate and the fluctuation in the exchange rate. And in fact, the something I haven't mentioned is actually the changes in the price of steel. It goes up and down all the time, and that in itself is problematic. People enter into contracts, and you don't know what you're actually contracting for. The price could drop, the price could go up, and you certainly don't know. Yes, international competitors enjoy assistance and they enjoy protection. And we have a little of both. And the thing I just want to say is that South African companies do meet international standards, whether it be quality, delivery, reliability, etc. We've proven ourselves internationally many, many times. So I recommend yeah, we'd like to see a favorable environment for investment in South African projects. It's only if there are projects, construction projects happening out there that the construction industry can respond to that. And of course the mining industry in particular, we believe there's a lot of scope for its growth. We must find ways of supporting the downstream industry, and part of that indeed is through steel pricing. Unfortunately, a number of companies, Hycroft Steel for example, made big losses over the last 6 months. The other smaller steel mills, Score, Fredgate, whatever, Cisco, are certainly not in a very strong position at all. And I think what the one big issue, one problem is doing things or imposing things on ArcelorMittal without making the other guys go bust. That, I think, is certainly a challenge. And then protecting the industry against imported products through duties and through projects, through better legislation. But in any case, strengthening interdepartmental cooperation when it gets to these things, quicker decision-making, and cooperating, of course, with people like ourselves. Chair, that's all we have to say. Thank you.
I must say you have been very concise and managed to prioritize the key elements in this regard. Indeed, your position and presentation is a no reflection of God for the position and importance of steel in general, not at all. So there shouldn't be any other perception taken other than Paris. So perhaps we can leave it there. Now, members, thank you very much indeed, Dr. de Klerk. And your colleague, of course, I'm sure contributed in some manner. Members, it's over to yourselves. I must say, previously, you certainly set a really good precedent on questions and clarifications. So I do hope we won't go off, you know, the track now. Thank you. So, let's have the names then. Hands up, please, honourable members. Honourable Alberts. Yes, Honourable Harris. Honourable September. Honourable Khadebe. Honourable Kwabasa. I would hope, Honourable Ambrosini, you weren't intending to speak. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I would just like to focus on your recommendations that you made on page 13. You said that the mining industry needs to be supported, and I would just like to have your ideas on what exactly that support would entail, given the problems that we currently have in the mining industry. The same goes for the seeking ways to support exports by the downstream industry through steel pricing. If you can just give us some examples or any structural views on how that would be done. And then on the fourth bullet point, protect the industry against imported products and projects. With regards to projects and the proposed legislation, do you have any views on that type of legislation and whether that would be the Competition Act itself? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Albert. Honourable Harris?
Thanks, Chair. We heard a few weeks ago about, the department came and told us about an agreement that AMSA had with exporters that they wouldn't re-import steel. Can you comment on that agreement, if you know about it, or if you're involved in any way? Then your analysis of the exports, the 25 truckloads shipped or driven across borders, that amount, do you believe that amount is constrained by the ports or the road network or perhaps the lack of rail?
I'm relatively impressed with the amount we're exporting into Africa, but do you believe that there are structural constraints preventing those exports from being higher, and what exactly are they? Obviously, your question about taking a year for the response to the alleged allegations of Indian dumping to be processed by the department raises concerns. So I think, Chair, we should direct that at the department. I understand it's not Mr. Zog's responsibility, but perhaps he could comment, since he's here representing the department, on why it did take so long for that to be processed. Then, towards the end, you mentioned, I think there were unintended consequences of whatever interventions we decide to impose with regards to AMSA affecting smaller producers. Can you expand a little bit on that point? It wasn't something I'd considered, but obviously if whatever we do with AMSA for some reason affects negatively the rest of the industry, that's something we don't want. If anything, we want to be promoting more competition rather than less. And then lastly, to the departments, when do you expect the task team's work to be completed? When will the committee get sight of that? And secondly, you mentioned in your previous reply, rather, that there was a lack of competition, of scale competition in the region. But I've been reading in the papers the sale of the Zimbabwean steel producer. My question is the department engaging with Zimbabwe on that sale? I mean, I understand they have scale to provide some degree of competition to AMSA, but I also understand that AMSA is one of the bidders for that purchase. Is this something that the department should be doing along with international cooperation? And how does that, what would the impact of the Zimbabwean steel producer coming back online properly be on the South African market? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable September.
Sure, thank you very much, and thank you for the presentation also. I was intrigued by one of your slides that spoke to the exports. And if I got it right, you said that you export more than what you import. That being the case, in most instances when countries or individual industries take that decision, they do so for very many different reasons. So I'd like to find out the exports that you are having, how much of that, are they absolute raw materials, and how much do they come back into the country in another form? And if that other form could not have been beneficiated in the country at all. And then secondly, I'd like to find out, you said something about, you spoke quite at length about the industries, quite fine and all of that, but you said something to the extent of, but there are other things. I didn't hear what the other things were that you said could be the problem. If you maybe could elaborate on that, then it will help us. I think you tried to say that the steel price is not the problem, there are other things. Maybe there are other things you could tell us, then it will help. And then, Chair, lastly, on the recommendations that you have made, there's quite a number of them that you have said here, and some of it not necessarily have been elaborated on. I'm interested to find that the first one that you recommend is the creation of a favorable environment for investments in projects in the country. Can you explain to us what is the unfavorable environment that we are having in the country? And are they policy related? Are they related to any of our legislative environment? And then also the protection that you are asking for, is it a protection that you ask that goes back to the kind of protection that we had before 1994? If you could maybe just again give us a bit detail on that and why we should be going that route. Chair, thank you.
Honourable Khadebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. Although my question was already covered by the Honourable Albert, the issue of the mining industry needing to be supported, really I think that there must be an expansion there. What do they mean in particular? And then again on page 12, there's still the issue of mining industry in limbo because of uncertainty. What is that? Because when you look at the figures every day, what is being exported? Our iron ore, which we shipped out of the country. I don't know what do they mean when they say that the mining industry is in limbo. Because you look at other sectors within the mining, just like platinum, it really is prospering day in, day out. Now, what do they mean when they say that it is in limbo? And then on the under conclusions is the issue of the domestic competition is in on a level playing field with local steel prices or below import parity. Can they expatiate what do they mean by that? Because I think from what we heard all over is that the issue of import parity pricing on steel is affecting negatively the industry itself. So what do they mean that we are on the level playing field? Because then the canners will not be crying the way they are crying now. Also, not only the canners, the other sectors of who are the consumers of steel, they are crying that the prices are above what is expected of them. And then the issue of the duties. You know, with Chairperson, we attended the presentation of ITEC before we left. They said that the ITEC said that they had just turned around the time frame. It is now takes about 6 months to put the duties in place. So when this assertion was made, was it done from the previous study from last year, or is it the turnaround strategy of the ITEC taken into consideration? And then the issue of the involvement of industry association, I always expected that the Department of Trade Union is one of the shining examples of interaction with the industry players. So now we find that as if that thing is not escalated enough, what do they mean that more involvement? I already thought that they were already involved, even up to this point. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Khadebe, Honourable Khobasa.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I wanted to ask a question similar to the one Honourable September asked about the protection that you're referring to. If you could be more specific, given the fact that in the international trade negotiations, there are rules which govern what kind of assistance you may give, which is, or may not give, which would define whether you're talking about assistance that is within the rules of the WTO, so that we don't do things that would suggest we are beginning to be protectionist. The second question, you made reference to the mining sector being in limbo and you're suggesting that it should be supported. If you could suggest ideas perhaps on how, in the first instance, if you could explain what is it that makes the mining industry be in limbo. In what sense are you saying it is in limbo? And secondly, how it could be assisted?
Right, thank you very much. It would be helpful if you could just expand on, once you perhaps have the time, and if you don't, you can do so in writing. You were doing a number of comparisons here. On the different figures, etc., imports, exports, etc. And it would be useful
if we could have an annotated, although I see that we do have here with us quite a detailed, which I haven't read myself, and perhaps you've done that, where those matrices are actually, you know, fully explained. If that is the case, then we can leave it for a while. And I just wanted, you know, I may have got the wrong impression. Perceptions are so easy to get wrong. We had a lot here earlier on this morning, of course, dealing with one other aspect of the steel industry, which I suppose you could argue has a direct impact on, the larger section of the community who are in the lower income bracket, if I may put it that way, and so on. Now, of course, we're dealing, and we accept this, IPAP is dealing very strongly with enhancing and growing industrialization, which of course includes structural steel and the like. But I'm not sure if you were making a case for, well, look, if you're in the industry producing steel or whatever you're producing, you have a right to whatever profit your shareholders are demanding. I mean, my own view is that if you're an industry or any organization, you're entitled to what I call a profit. But we're talking of another aspect, what your shareholders demand. And that accordingly, the relevant organization should get its cut, if you like, of whatever intervention government is making with respect to, can we call it financial resources. Now, I may have got the wrong impression here, and I would certainly like you to clarify that so that I go away with the point you were trying to make clearly in my head. Thank you.
Chair, I'd like to ask my colleague, Mr. Kovis de Beer, to start the answers.
Chair, thank you very much. It's actually quite interesting to realize how some of the issues that we think we communicate very clearly, we don't necessarily do so. You will have to forgive me. Some of your questions I didn't quite follow. I may want to ask you to just clarify that a little bit. I think the question of the mining industry has come up a number of times. The comparison we make is actually just, we look at Brazil, for example. We like to learn from Brazil. We see them as a potential export market for us. We see them as a potential threat for importing in South Africa. And what we're seeing is that the investment in the mining industry in Brazil is growing very rapidly. And there's enormous drive towards further investment there. And we're disappointed that we're not seeing the same thing in South Africa. Now, we're not sure that the simple solution of blaming the ANC Youth League for making some comments or whatnot is the effect of that. But our concern is we as industrialists see that there's investment growth in countries like Brazil, and we're not seeing the same in South Africa. You're quite right. The iron ore is booming, platinum is booming, gold prices at the better price ever. But if you have to today list the 10 gold mining projects that's currently happening in South Africa comprising new investment, you would have extreme difficulty getting past 5. And most of those that are happening are just sort of upgrading existing facilities and so forth. So we're concerned about that. And we don't propose for a minute that we understand the answer. But we are very intimately involved with the problem. And the problem is that we believe there's a contribution that should be, that we, our industry should be making to invest in the mining industry that's not currently happening at the scale that we see in other countries. And we think that we're missing an opportunity there. The type of assistance we're talking about, you know, we compete with the Indian companies. And a lot of the comments made about the World Trade Organization and some of the agreements are very valid. What we see is that the Indians come with a power pylon, galvanized, fabricated, holes made in it, parceled, delivered in Durban at a price that's sometimes 20% below what we can do. Now, we don't know how they do it, but we do know we can't buy cheaper steel from India. We've tried. We can't buy steel at $600 a ton from China. We tried. So what we can do is to get bargains for value-added product. And the moment we make an analysis of the price and the cost that goes into it and the steel material that goes into it, we say these guys are dumping. They have some form of assistance that we can't emulate. Sometimes in China, it's because the steel mill also owns the fabricator. Places like India, you have a similar situation that you have the mill and the downstream fabricator and the galvanizer all being supported by the same company. You don't know how they get their final prices, but you do know they're knocking spots off us and we actually can't compete with them. That's why we say we believe they're dumping, and we think that they're actually being subsidized in ways which are perhaps gap-proof, but not. In China, for example, one of the major investment or advantages our competitors have is that the capital investment into the property and into the facilities is actually done by the government or by one of the local municipalities. And the company doing the job is not actually paying for the cost of being there and the cost of the equipment and the cost of the facilities it's creating. So they found a way to indirectly subsidize them, and it's maybe GATT-proof or WTA-proof, but it gives the effect that they can compete with us in a way that we find extremely difficult to compete with. The question of exporting those 25 truckloads, if you look at the previous year, you'll see that we exported almost 100,000 tons more. So I don't think there's a practical restraint on how much we can export. I think we actually provided this an opportunity. I don't think in this industry there's a practical limitation. Just to clarify something, we're talking about fabricated structural steel. In other words, the value has already been added. It's got cutting, it's got pieces welded on, it's got holes in it, it's got paint, it's got galvanizing, so it doesn't come back as for someone else. It's not raw material or raw steel we're selling, it's actually processed steel. Final product, yeah. So it's something that we actually... it's a good type of export, because it's not the kind of thing that comes back in one way or another. Any, I think you must just take a run off.
You see, my colleague runs out of steam pretty quickly. Sort of. We don't know about the re-importing steel agreement. There was a thing some while ago, when people imported hard-pulp steel from Kenya and brought it back here, because it was provided on a very competitive basis, only to specific people, and they could export it. And it landed up in Kenya so cheaply that we could import it back here, and it would still be cheaper than local product. To my knowledge, I simply don't know whether there's, and I would think that everybody would be too scared of the Competitions Commission in any case to do such a thing. In terms of the infrastructure situation, Kuba's reply to that, a lot of our product goes by road. So, and the harbour facilities and so on, in general, I don't think there are real significant infrastructural constraints in terms of exporting or distributing our product. In terms of the unintended consequences, I certainly cannot claim to be even vaguely an authority on the pricing systems in the among the steel mills. What happens, of course, with the smaller producers, the Scores and USCO and whatnot, that they actually live on scrap. So they buy scrap steel, what used to be a car or whatever, and they remelt that using electric arc furnaces and make a product out of that. Often that product is a fairly low value product, such as reinforcing steel, etc. And the margin between the price of scrap and the final product is not high. That information I have on good authority. And so, but ArcelorMittal sets the prices for steel in this country. So the moment ArcelorMittal's prices drop, everybody's dropped. You can just watch it. That's just the way it goes. Without any collusion that I know of. I just simply don't know. I'm not there. But the, if you put a lid on their prices, they could easily run into trouble. I could also, and perhaps that relates to your question, Chair, at the end, about the fair profit situation. We have, as I mentioned, Heifel Steel, which belongs to the Russian company Evraz. If I were Evraz, I would sort of really ask questions whether I actually want to continue with this investment in South Africa. Their plant is close to 50 years old, and not in a good shape at all. From an environmental point of view, that factory has huge problems. They need to invest significantly in order to just maintain their facility. And as it is, they've been making losses. They certainly coined it during the period up to 2008. But that is certainly not the case anymore. And as I say, we have that threat. And I must admit, you know, we're dealing, in terms of AMSA, with the richest man in the world. If he doesn't get his buck, he can easily close the shop and go home. And, you know, I thought the threat to close Saldanha was actually reckless. I was immensely angered by that. I thought, you know, one shouldn't play with people's livelihoods in that sort of way. The problem is that it's credible. He can turn the key any day of the week. And you know, I don't like to be threatened. I certainly hate it. At the same time, there comes a point where you actually have to listen to somebody threatening you. So you make up your minds as to what that would be. I think I'm passing back to my colleague now, thanks. He must have raised it a bit.
Just an intervening question directed at DTI, which may have an impact on what you say as well.
Chair, I think there have been a couple of issues directly or indirectly raised in the presentation that do link to DTI, and I was hoping that, as well as responding to the members' question, that I could also respond to some of these and kind of put it in the context in which we see things. I think the first is that...
Yeah, Mr. Zolk, we certainly want to allow that, but as it's 20-2 and this room, E249, has been taken over at 2, we would need to stop at 5-2. So that gives us 15 minutes to complete everything. So some of what you have to say, you need to just review it for mentally, can come back in written form, and others you would certainly prefer for it to be on record now.
Thanks, Chair. I'll try and be as brief as I possibly can. I think that I'm trying to understand the logic of the presentation, and if I paraphrase it, the way I understand it is as follows, is that there's an argument that's essentially saying that, look, there are a number of factors which I think we all agree with, and I think we should reiterate the point that was made earlier, that there are a number of factors that determine competitiveness, and we need to operate on all of them. Now, the argument that's being made is that steel price is not a factor in the domestic market, even though the example given of the Indian pylon illustrates that it is actually profoundly a factor in competitiveness. I think the argument that's being made is that the fiscus, in the form of tariffs, in the form of other forms of incentives, actually needs to subsidize a relatively high domestic steel price and compensate for that. And I think that our view is that that can't be the case. I think what we need is action on a number of fronts. Yes, we need to, you know, intelligently use tariffs. We need to look how we structure other forms of incentives. But we also need to tackle the high steel price, not subsidize it. I think that the presentation raises some very relevant issues. The role of merchants, I think, is very important. One question that arises, given also from our observation that it on the face of it appears markups of the merchants seem to be fairly high, why isn't there more entry into the sector, and are there anti-competitive practices or conduct that's preventing that? I think the issues on, I think it's not necessarily a very good way to look at pricing by saying this is the relative cost of steel in a product. If you look at a car, there's very intense competition in the automotive industry and most other kind of componentry for at every single point of the value chain and every single piece of componentry. So when an automotive manufacturer decides, are they going to assemble in South Africa or are they going to assemble somewhere else, it doesn't matter to them what the price of steel in the car is. They want to know is how much are you going to pay for steel in South Africa versus somewhere else. And the same is true of every piece of componentry that goes into a car that embodies steel, and every other, you know, and every other piece of steel products, tubes, pipes, valves, whatever the case may be. I've conferred with my colleague on the tariff application, and I think here this is where maybe we need to speak, you know, the industry and ourselves need to speak a bit more closely so that the industry understands what the process is. In order to get a tariff in place, you actually formally have to put in an application. Now, my understanding from my colleague is that this was done in April of this year, which means that actually ITAC is bang on target in terms of gazetting now to meet its six-month commitment that it's made to the industry. So I think overall, clearly we need to strengthen our interaction with the industry. Very last point, we need to be very, very careful in putting in place direct export incentives. These are directly forbidden by the World Trade Organization, and I think it could pose very, very serious problems for us in our trade relations in putting in place direct export incentives.
For the moment.
Thank you, Chair.
Yes, and I know that you will, of course, come back to the committee with something more detailed in writing. Thank you very much. Back to yourselves, Dr. de Klerk and your colleague, Mr. de Beer.
Thank you very much. Mr. Zalka, I appreciate your comments because we actually agree with you. We're not fishing for subsidies from the fiscus. We think there are better ways of doing that. And very specifically, it has to do with project finance. It has to do with bulking, offering complete projects rather than just elements of that and so forth. And I think there's room for us to actually cooperate on that. The areas where you were talking about legislation, the things that we worry about are where you're competing with an imported project like the cement plant. We don't know that the minimum wage laws, the hours of work, the many of the agreements that we painfully come to with unions on an annual basis and renew, we see this as a way to circumvent that. And I think we have a joint interest in actually not letting that rule and not create an escape hatch for people to sidestep some of the domestic rules that we make in terms of our labor and other things. I think the type of assistance we think we should be developing has more to do with streamlining your method of export, looking at the cost of actually transportation, looking at your insurances, looking at your finances. A lot of the Chinese that come and beat us, for example, offer a complete package. You don't have to start paying for it till they've completed building it. They actually bring in all the disciplines, including the road building and some of the things that go with it. And I think, and it's not something we're really looking to the government on its own to deal with. I think we need to join hands and actually become part of that. If you look at the power pylons again, this is an example where I think we're failing and where we have a far better chance. If the industry and Eskom and government sit together, have a working team on the power pylons to say we now need for the 765 lines, we need for the next two or three years, thousands of tons of power pylons. We should have a master plan that harnesses all our resources, aim for a better price than we would have got otherwise, and we should really, and that's the type of involvement we propagating. We think the industry and associations and government would actually form a forum which in terms of competitions law is now becoming quite difficult to actually get together. But I think we should do that because it's in the national interest that we do that, and we believe we should participate. And that's more the type of thing we're trying to propagate than trying to look for someone to give us some money to do exports and so forth.
Sorry, Chair. I realized there were two questions that Honourable Harris raised that I didn't respond to.
Thank you to yourselves then, for the moment, Dr. de Klerk and Mr. de Beer. Yes, I just want to check with Honourable Harris. I think there's an attempt by DTI to respond to some of your outstanding questions. Thank you.
Just very quickly, Chair. It isn't possible at this stage to give a precise date at which the task team is able to come and report back to the portfolio committee. But we are meeting this week with ministers, and I imagine that ministers will be in contact with the chair of the portfolio committee to arrange that. Secondly, on the sale of Zisco, I understand that there have been a number of expressions of interest from various players, and IDC has also, together with possible joint venture partner, also looked at it. I think there are a number of complexities with Zisco. The one is it's a very, very old, it's not actually operational. It's a plant that's old, it's not running at the moment. It will require a lot of resuscitation to get it back up and running. I think the other complexity is that from the Zimbabwean side, they want to see a certain return, and that may or may not be viable relative to the state of the plant and what it would cost to get up and running. So those are some of the complexities around the Zisco sale.
Thank you very much, Mr. Zolk. Honourable Harris, I think that may have addressed your concerns, does it? Yes. Now, having come to this particular point, it's, as usual, quite clear. The time has never been on our side. This is a very, very important inquiry. It is of strategic national importance. I think we all agree on that, although we're coming from different areas, sectors, and so on, and perhaps with different points of view. And I would certainly, I think the committee would agree with me that we always welcome members of the industry sharing with us some of the challenges and their views in this particular area. So thank you very much, and I certainly hope you will engage with the committee secretary to see what it is we may still require in writing. In terms of the committee, yes, it's just before 10:02, and just a quick look at the program that we have before us here. I understand from the committee secretary that he did make available to you electronically
the program, and you would be aware that there had to be one or two changes, if not more, because we've also been made aware of by the department, by the minister and so on, that the company's legislation, the amendment, has not yet gone to cabinet, certainly at the time of the communication. And clearly all of that's got to happen, and it's got to be tabled before we can move on it in any way. So there was no way that we could begin dealing with it next week, as it were. So we will, of course, keep that in mind. That's one. Secondly, we're cognizant of the fact that we really have something like 7 weeks, if we're fortunate. And in that time, we do need to conclude the IP legislation itself. As you know, it has been before us since this committee began this term, and it was certainly in the present in the last term. And it is certainly not our practice to put legislation as important as this on hold for this length of time, unless there is a very critical reason why this should be the case. The third thing is we do need to report back on the second draft of the WTO, and you've certainly had all this, of course, as you know, and we need to deliberate and pass it so that it can go before the House itself. Thirdly, there's a need to report back to the committee by the IP task team, who, I'm sure you're aware, met in constituency on two occasions, on the one occasion led by the task team leader, the subcommittee leader, Honourable September, and at least I think you met, I think so, yes. And on the second occasion, was not able to participate. So many of us were involved in what can only be described as critical constituency work, including by-elections and the like. So the rest of us carried on, and I'm happy to see Honourable Albert's back after that nasty scare of intensive unit and everything, and I certainly wouldn't want the mention of an IP meeting to send anyone else to the intensive care unit. So we hope that, well, you know, we do understand, of course, and it may have given me the opportunity to catch up as well on what had already passed before my presence. Now, I'm not sure, and I'm looking at the members of the task team, the Honourable September and myself would still need to confer, and Honourable Alberts would need to be brought on board again, you know, towards the end. And I think the Honourable Harris, were you present at both? And then you have the advantage over all of us. And then the Honourable Kwabasa, I know, not sure if you were present at the first meeting. Yes. So we do need ourselves, all of us, to just get together, even if for half an hour, so that we go to the committee with one position, broadly speaking. And we haven't done that. So I know the committee secretary is insisting on me looking at something, but I have been overtaken, as usual, by the speaker's office that is requiring a presentation on the IPM, and I'm not looking at exactly when this is. So without saying, yes, it'll be at 9, perhaps we can agree, and then the Honourable September and myself can have a meeting this afternoon so that she's able to lead that particular task team again effectively at 9 o'clock. And then there is the issue of the Consumer Protection Act, the NCR. I was a speaker there recently, and to my surprise, there were something like 600 people present. What do they call themselves? Debt counsellors and the like. And you know, these are people, practitioners who are implementing part of the act, very important act, and a number of issues have come to light, and I believe that this, it's critical that this is shared with you urgently, the ramifications and the some of the unintended consequences of the current legislation, but also some of the challenges that are being faced and what measures the NCR are taking with the support of the department to address it. Now, that was factored in for Thursday, the 14th of October, and would appear to be still on track at this stage. But I must just emphasize, the intellectual property is taking precedence. Property Laws Amendment Bill will take precedence at this stage. We will also, of course, need to just go over the Eastern Cape Oversight Visit report. And my appeal to members of the Portfolio Committee, please, please read these reports. Consult your political principles, because you won't be getting any more time than is given here. Some of these reports have been out more than 6 weeks. So please study them and come back ready to deliberate on them. Study the intellectual property laws. Please do. And don't leave it all to, of course, the task team. We had overlooked to some degree, I say overlooked it, we hadn't in really, but perhaps the program somehow couldn't factor it in. Kumba. You know, steel is what we're dealing with, including the inputs. You know, what are these raw materials and so on and minerals? And I do not think Kumba can be left alone as some sort of champion of the consumer and so on. I think that we do need to interrogate them. They did send me an invitation to go on a very nicely prepared public relations visit to the mine and the community, but I don't think that's going to be constructive at all and a waste of my time. So I think we first need to deal with the issue, and then visits we can consider at our leisure and not when we're so pressed for time. Now, is there any comment on this very, very heavy program so far without even referring to the budget review recommendations and the annual report? Yes, Honourable Ariane Abrasini.
Yes, I need to excuse myself. I'm meeting an economic development apologist.
Yes, indeed, we are leaving ourselves literally in 10 to 20 seconds. So I think you can take your seat. Is there anyone else? No. Now that we've enabled us to leave as one committee...